The Filter Bubble: What the Internet is Hiding from You, by Eli Pariser. Narrated by Kirby Hayborn. Copyright 2011 by Eli Pariser. This unabridged audiobook is published by arrangement with the Penguin Press, a member of Penguin Group USA, Incorporated, and was produced in 2011 by Tantor Media Incorporated, which holds the copyright thereto. Introduction. A squirrel dying in front of your house may be more relevant to your interests right now than people dying in Africa. Mark Zuckerberg, Facebook founder. We shape our tools, and thereafter, our tools shape us. Marshall McLuhan, media theorist. Few people noticed the post that appeared on Google's corporate blog on December 4, 2009. It didn't beg for attention. No sweeping pronouncements, no Silicon Valley hype, just a few paragraphs of text sandwiched between a weekly roundup of top search terms and an update about Google's finance software. Not everyone missed it. Search engineer blogger Danny Sullivan pores over the items on Google's blog looking for clues about where the monolith is headed next, and to him, the post was a big deal. In fact, he wrote later that day, it was the biggest change that has ever happened in search engines. For Danny, the headline said it all. Personalized search for everyone. Starting that morning, Google would use 57 signals, everything from where you were logging in from to what browser you were using to what you had searched for before, to make guesses about who you were and what kinds of sites you'd like. Even if you were logged out, it would customize its results, showing you the pages it predicted you were most likely to click on. Most of us assume that when we Google a term, we all see the same results, the ones that the company's famous PageRank algorithm suggests are the most authoritative based on other pages' links. But since December 2009, this is no longer true. Now you get the result that Google's algorithm suggests is best for you in particular, and someone else may see something entirely different. In other words, there is no standard Google anymore. It's not hard to see this difference in action. In the spring of 2010, while the remains of the Deepwater Horizon oil rig were spewing crude oil into the Gulf of Mexico, I asked two friends to search for the term BP. They're pretty similar, educated, white, left-leaning women who live in the Northeast. But the results they saw were quite different. One of my friends saw investment information about BP. The other saw news. For one, the first page of results contained links about the oil spill. For the other, there was nothing about it except for a promotional ad from BP. Even the number of results returned by Google differed. About 180 million results for one friend and 139 million for the other. If the results were that different for these two progressive East Coast women, imagine how different they would be for my friends and, say, an elderly Republican in Texas, or, for that matter, a businessman in Japan. With Google personalized for everyone, the query stem cells might produce diametrically opposed results for scientists who support stem cell research and activists who oppose it. Proof of climate change might turn up different results for an environmental activist and an oil company executive. In polls, a huge majority of us assume search engines are unbiased. But that may be just because they're increasingly biased to share our own views. More and more, your computer monitor is a kind of one-way mirror, reflecting your own interests while algorithmic observers watch what you click. Google's announcement marked the turning point of an important but nearly invisible revolution in how we consume information. You could say that on December 4th, 2009, the era of personalization began. When I was growing up in rural Maine in the 1990s, a new Wired arrived at our farmhouse every month, full of stories about AOL and Apple and how hackers and technologists were changing the world. To my preteen self, it seemed clear that the Internet was going to democratize the world, connecting us with better information and the power to act on it. The California futurists and techno-optimists in those pages spoke with a clear-eyed certainty. An inevitable, irresistible revolution was just around the corner, one that would flatten society, unseat the elites, and usher in a kind of freewheeling global utopia. During college, I taught myself HTML and some rudimentary pieces of the languages PHP and SQL. I dabbled in building websites for friends and college projects. And when an email referring people to a website I had started went viral after 9/11, I was suddenly put in touch with 500,000 people from 192 countries. To a 20-year-old, it was an extraordinary experience. In a matter of days, I had ended up at the center of a small movement. It was also overwhelming. So I joined forces with another small civic-minded startup from Berkeley called MoveOn.org. The co-founders, Wes Boyd and Joan Blades, had built a software company that brought the world the Flying Toasters screensaver. Our lead programmer was a 20-something libertarian named Patrick Kane. His consulting service, We Also Walk Dogs, was named after a sci-fi story. Carrie Olson, a veteran of the Flying Toaster days, managed operations. We all worked out of our homes. The work itself was mostly unglamorous, formatting and sending out emails, building web pages, but it was exciting because we were sure the Internet had the potential to usher in a new era of transparency. The prospect that leaders could directly communicate for free with constituents could change everything, and the Internet gave constituents new power to aggregate their efforts and make their voices heard. When we looked at Washington, we saw a system clogged with gatekeepers and bureaucrats. The Internet had the potential to wash all of that away. When I joined Move On in 2001, we had about 500,000 U.S. members. Today, there are 5 million members, making it one of the largest advocacy groups in America, significantly larger than the NRA. Together, our members have given over $120 million in small donations to support causes we've identified together: healthcare for everyone, a green economy, and a flourishing democratic process, to name a few. For a time, it seemed that the Internet was going to entirely redemocratize society. Bloggers and citizen journalists would single-handedly rebuild the public media. Politicians would be able to run, only with a broad base of support from small, everyday donors. Local governments would become more transparent and accountable to their citizens. And yet, the era of civic connection I dreamed about hasn't come. Democracy requires citizens to see things from one another's point of view, but instead, we're more and more enclosed in our own bubbles. Democracy requires a reliance on shared facts. Instead, we're being offered parallel but separate universes. My sense of unease crystallized when I noticed that my conservative friends had disappeared from my Facebook page. Politically, I lean to the left, but I like to hear what conservatives are thinking, and I've gone out of my way to befriend a few and add them as Facebook connections. I wanted to see what links they'd post, read their comments, and learn a bit from them. But their links never turned up in my top news feed. Facebook was apparently doing the math and noticing that I was still clicking my progressive friends' links more than my conservative friends, and links to the latest Lady Gaga videos more than either. So, no conservative links for me. I started doing some research, trying to understand how Facebook was deciding what to show me and what to hide. As it turned out, Facebook wasn't alone. With little notice or fanfare, the digital world is fundamentally changing. What was once an anonymous medium where anyone could be anyone, where, in the words of the famous New Yorker cartoon, nobody knows you're a dog, is now a tool for soliciting and analyzing our personal data. According to one Wall Street Journal study, the top 50 internet sites, from CNN to Yahoo to MSN, install an average of 64 data-laden cookies and personal tracking beacons each. Search for a word like depression on dictionary.com, and the site installs up to 223 tracking cookies and beacons on your computer so that other websites can target you with antidepressants. Share an article about cooking on ABC News, and you may be chased around the web by ads for Teflon-coated pots. Open, even for an instant, a page listing signs that your spouse may be cheating, and prepare to be haunted with DNA paternity test ads. The new internet doesn't just know you're a dog, it knows your breed and wants to sell you a bowl of premium kibble. The race to know as much as possible about you has become the central battle of the era for internet giants like Google, Facebook, Apple, and Microsoft. As Chris Palmer of the Electronic Frontier Foundation explained to me, you're getting a free service, and the cost is information about you. And Google and Facebook translate that pretty directly into money. While Gmail and Facebook may be helpful free tools, they are also extremely effective and voracious extraction engines into which we pour the most intimate details of our lives. Your smooth new iPhone knows exactly where you go, whom you call, what you read. With its built-in microphone, gyroscope, and GPS, it can tell whether you're walking, or in a car, or at a party. While Google has, so far, promised to keep your personal data to itself, other popular websites and apps, from the airfare site Kayak.com to the sharing widget Add This, make no such guarantees. Behind the pages you visit, a massive new market for information about what you do online is growing, driven by low-profile but highly profitable personal data companies like BlueKai and Axiom. Axiom alone has accumulated an average of 1,500 pieces of data on each person on its database, which includes 96% of Americans, along with data about everything from their credit scores to whether they've bought medication for incontinence. And using lightning-fast protocols, any website, not just the Googles and Facebooks of the world, can now participate in the fun. In the view of the behavior market vendors, every click signal you create is a commodity, and every move of your mouse can be auctioned off within microseconds to the highest commercial bidder. As a business strategy, the internet giant's formula is simple. The more personally relevant their information offerings are, the more ads they can sell, and the more likely you are to buy the products they're offering. And the formula works. Amazon sells billions of dollars in merchandise by predicting what each customer is interested in and putting it in the front of the virtual store. Up to 60% of Netflix's rentals come from the personalized guesses it can make about each customer's movie preferences. And at this point, Netflix can predict how much you'll like a given movie within about half a star. Personalization is a core strategy for the top five sites on the internet: Yahoo, Google, Facebook, YouTube, and Microsoft Live, as well as countless others. In the next 3 to 5 years, Facebook COO Sheryl Sandberg told One Group, "The idea of a website that isn't customized to a particular user will seem quaint." Yahoo Vice President Tapan Bhatt agrees. The future of the web is about personalization. Now the web is about me. It's about weaving the web together in a way that is smart and personalized for the user. Google CEO Eric Schmidt enthuses that the product I've always wanted to build is Google code that will guess what I'm trying to type. Google Instant, which guesses what you're searching for as you type and was rolled out in the fall of 2010, is just the start. Schmidt believes that what customers want is for Google to tell them what they should be doing next. It would be one thing if all this customization was just about targeted advertising. But personalization isn't just shaping what we buy. For a quickly rising percentage of us, personalized news feeds like Facebook are becoming a primary news source. 36% of Americans under 30 get their news through social networking sites. And Facebook's popularity is skyrocketing worldwide, with nearly 1 million more people joining each day. As founder Mark Zuckerberg likes to brag, Facebook may be the biggest source of news in the world, at least for some definitions of news. And personalization is shaping how information flows far beyond Facebook, as websites from Yahoo News to the New York Times-funded startup News.me cater their headlines to our particular interests and desires. It's influencing what videos we watch on YouTube and a dozen smaller competitors, and what blog posts we see. It's affecting whose emails we get, which potential mates we run into on OkCupid, and which restaurants are recommended to us on Yelp, which means that personalization could easily have a hand not only in who goes on a date with whom, but in where they go and what they talk about. The algorithms that orchestrate our ads are starting to orchestrate our lives. The basic code at the heart of the new internet is pretty simple. The new generation of internet filters looks at the things you seem to like, the actual things you've done, or the things people like you like, and tries to extrapolate. They are prediction engines, constantly creating and refining a theory of who you are and what you'll do and want next. Together, these engines create a unique universe of information for each of us, what I've come to call a filter bubble, which fundamentally alters the way we encounter ideas and information. Of course, to some extent, we've always consumed media that appealed to our interests and avocations and ignored much of the rest. But the filter bubble introduces three dynamics we've never dealt with before. First, you're alone in it. A cable channel that caters to a narrow interest, say, golf, has other viewers with whom you share a frame of reference. But you're the only person in your bubble. In an age when shared information is the bedrock of shared experience, the filter bubble is a centrifugal force pulling us apart. Second, the filter bubble is invisible. Most viewers of conservative or liberal news sources know that they're going to a station curated to serve a particular political viewpoint. But Google's agenda is opaque. Google doesn't tell you who it thinks you are or why it's showing you the results you're seeing. You don't know if its assumptions about you are right or wrong, and you might not even know it's making assumptions about you in the first place. My friend who got more investment-oriented information about BP still has no idea why that was the case. She's not a stockbroker. Because you haven't chosen the criteria by which sites filter information in and out, it's easy to imagine that the information that comes through a filter bubble is unbiased, objective, true. But it's not. In fact, from within the bubble, it's nearly impossible to see how biased it is. Finally, you don't choose to enter the bubble. When you turn on Fox News or read The Nation, you're making a decision about what kind of filter to use to make sense of the world. It's an active process, and like putting on a pair of tinted glasses, you can guess how the editor's leaning shapes your perception. You don't make the same kind of choice with personalized filters. They come to you. And because they drive up profits for the websites that use them, they'll become harder and harder to avoid. Of course, there's a good reason why personalized filters have such a powerful allure. We are overwhelmed by a torrent of information. 900,000 blog posts, 50 million tweets, more than 60 million Facebook status updates, and 210 billion emails are sent off into the electronic ether every day. Eric Schmidt likes to point out that if you recorded all human communication from the dawn of time to 2003, it'd take up about 5 billion gigabytes of storage space. Now, we're creating that much data every 2 days. Even the pros are struggling to keep up. The National Security Agency, which copies a lot of the internet traffic that flows through AT&T's main hub in San Francisco, is building 2 new stadium-sized complexes in the Southwest to process all that data. The biggest problem they face is a lack of power. There literally isn't enough electricity on the grid to support that much computing. The NSA is asking Congress for funds to build new power plants. By 2014, they anticipate dealing with so much data, they've invented new units of measurement just to describe it. Inevitably, this gives rise to what blogger and media analyst Steve Rubel calls the attention crash. As the cost of communicating over large distances and to large groups of people has plummeted, we're increasingly unable to attend to it all. Our focus flickers from text message to web clip to email, scanning the ever-widening torrent for the precious bits that are actually important or even just relevant is itself a full-time job. So, when personalized filters offer a hand, we're inclined to take it. In theory, anyway, they can help us find the information we need to know and see and hear, the stuff that really matters among the cat pictures and Viagra ads and treadmill dancing music videos. Netflix helps you find the right movie to watch in its vast catalog of 140,000 flicks. The genius function of iTunes calls new hits by your favorite band to your attention when they'd otherwise be lost. Ultimately, the proponents of personalization offer a vision of a custom-tailored world, every facet of which fits us perfectly. It's a cozy place, populated by our favorite people and things and ideas. If we never want to hear about reality TV or a more serious issue like gun violence again, we don't have to. And if we want to hear about every movement of Reese Witherspoon, we can. If we never click on the articles about cooking or gadgets or the world outside our country's borders, they simply fade away. We're never bored. We're never annoyed. Our media is a perfect reflection of our interests and desires. By definition, it's an appealing prospect, a return to a Ptolemaic universe in which the sun and everything else revolves around us. But it comes at a cost. Making everything more personal, we may lose some of the traits that made the internet so appealing to begin with. When I began the research that led to the writing of this book, personalization seemed like a subtle, even inconsequential shift. But when I considered what it might mean for a whole society to be adjusted in this way, it started to look more important. Though I follow tech developments pretty closely, I realized there was a lot I didn't know. How did personalization work? What was driving it? Where was it headed? And most important, what will it do to us? How will it change our lives? In the process of trying to answer these questions, I've talked to sociologists and salespeople, software engineers and law professors. I interviewed one of the founders of OkCupid, an algorithmically driven dating website, and one of the chief visionaries of the U.S. Information Warfare Bureau. I learned more than I ever wanted to know about the mechanics of online ad sales and search engines. I argued with cyber skeptics and cyber visionaries, and a few people who were both. Throughout my investigation, I was struck by the lengths one has to go to in order to fully see what personalization and filter bubbles do. When I interviewed Jonathan McPhee, Google's point man on search personalization, he suggested that it was nearly impossible to guess how the algorithms would shape the experience of any given user. There were simply too many variables and inputs to track. So while Google can look at overall clicks, it's much harder to say how it's working for any one person. I was also struck by the degree to which personalization is already upon us, not only on Facebook and Google, but on almost every major site on the web. I don't think the genie goes back in the bottle, Danny Sullivan told me. Though concerns about personalized media have been raised for a decade, legal scholar Cass Sunstein wrote a smart and provocative book on the topic in 2000, the theory is now rapidly becoming practice. Personalization is already much more a part of our daily experience than many of us realize. We can now begin to see how the filter bubble is actually working, where it's falling short, and what that means for our daily lives and our society. Every technology has an interface, Stanford Law Professor Ryan Kahlo told me, a place where you end and the technology begins. And when the technology's job is to show you the world, it ends up sitting between you and reality, like a camera lens. That's a powerful position, Kahlo says. There are lots of ways for it to skew your perception of the world, and that's precisely what the filter bubble does. The filter bubble's costs are both personal and cultural. There are direct consequences for those of us who use personalized filters, and soon enough, most of us will, whether we realize it or not. And there are societal consequences, which emerge when masses of people begin to live a filter-bubbled life. One of the best ways to understand how filters shape our individual experience is to think in terms of our information diet. As sociologist Dana Boyd said in a speech at the 2009 Web 2.0 Expo, our bodies are programmed to consume fat and sugars because they're rare in nature. In the same way, we're biologically programmed to be attentive to things that stimulate, content that is gross, violent, or sexual, and that gossip which is humiliating, embarrassing, or offensive. If we're not careful, we're going to develop the psychological equivalent of obesity. We'll find ourselves consuming content that is least beneficial for ourselves or society as a whole. Just as the factory farming system that produces and delivers our food shapes what we eat, the dynamics of our media shape what information we consume. Now we're quickly shifting toward a regimen chock full of personally relevant information, and while that can be helpful, too much of a good thing can also cause real problems. Left to their own devices, personalization filters serve up a kind of invisible auto-propaganda, indoctrinating us with our own ideas, amplifying our desire for things that are familiar, and leaving us oblivious to the dangers lurking in the dark territory of the unknown. In the filter bubble, there's less room for the chance encounters that bring insight and learning. Creativity is often sparked by the collision of ideas from different disciplines and cultures. Combine an understanding of cooking and physics, and you get the nonstick pan and the induction stovetop. But if Amazon thinks I'm interested in cookbooks, it's not very likely to show me books about metallurgy. It's not just serendipity that's at risk. By definition, a world constructed from the familiar is a world in which there's nothing to learn. If personalization is too acute, it could prevent us from coming into contact with the mind-blowing, preconception-shattering experiences and ideas that change how we think about the world and ourselves. And while the premise of personalization is that it provides you with a service, you're not the only person with a vested interest in your data. Researchers at the University of Minnesota recently discovered that women who are ovulating respond better to pitches for clingy clothes and suggested that marketers strategically time their online solicitations. With enough data, guessing this timing may be easier than you think. At best, if a company knows which articles you read or what mood you're in, it can serve up ads related to your interests. But at worst, it can make decisions on that basis that negatively affect your life. After you visit a page about third world backpacking, an insurance company with access to your web history might decide to increase your premium, law professor Jonathan Zittrain suggests. Parents who purchased Echometrics' Sentry software to track their kids online were outraged when they found that the company was then selling their kids' data to third-party marketing firms. Personalization is based on a bargain. In exchange for the service of filtering, you hand large companies an enormous amount of data about your daily life, much of which you might not trust friends with. These companies are getting better at drawing on this data to make decisions every day. But the trust we place in them to handle it with care is not always warranted, and when decisions are made on the basis of this data that affect you negatively, they're usually not revealed. Ultimately, the filter bubble can affect your ability to choose how you want to live. To be the author of your life, Professor Yochai Benkler argues, you have to be aware of a diverse array of options and lifestyles. When you enter a filter bubble, you're letting the companies that construct it choose which options you're aware of. You may think you're the captain of your own destiny, but personalization can lead you down a road to a kind of informational determinism in which what you've clicked on in the past determines what you see next, a web history you're doomed to repeat. You can get stuck in a static, ever-narrowing version of yourself, an endless U-loop. And there are broader consequences. In Bowling Alone, his best-selling book on the decline of civic life in America, Robert Putnam looked at the problem of the major decrease in social capital, the bonds of trust and allegiance that encourage people to do each other favors, work together to solve common problems, and collaborate. Putnam identified two kinds of social capital. There's the in-group-oriented bonding capital created when you attend a meeting of your college alumni, and then there's bridging capital, which is created at an event like a town meeting when people from lots of different backgrounds come together to meet each other. Bridging capital is potent. Build more of it, and you're more likely to be able to find that next job or an investor for your small business, because it allows you to tap into lots of different networks for help. Everybody expected the internet to be a huge source of bridging capital. Writing at the height of the dot-com bubble, Tom Friedman declared that the internet would make us all next-door neighbors. In fact, this idea was the core of his thesis in The Lexus and the Olive Tree. The internet is going to be like a huge vise that takes the globalization system and keeps tightening and tightening that system around everyone in ways that will only make the world smaller and smaller and faster with each passing day. Friedman seemed to have in mind a kind of global village in which kids in Africa and executives in New York would build a community together. But that's not what's happening. Our virtual next-door neighbors look more and more like our real-world neighbors, and our real-world neighbors look more and more like us. We're getting a lot of bonding, but very little bridging, and this is important because it's bridging that creates our sense of the public, the space where we address the problems that transcend our niches and narrow self-interests. We are predisposed to respond to a pretty narrow set of stimuli. If a piece of news is about sex, power, gossip, violence, celebrity, or humor, we are more likely to read it first. This is the content that most easily makes it into the filter bubble. It's easy to push like and increase the visibility of a friend's post about finishing a marathon or an instructional article about how to make onion soup. It's harder to push the like button on an article titled Darfur Sees Bloodiest Month in 2 Years. In a personalized world, important but complex or unpleasant issues, the rising prison population, for example, or homelessness, are less likely to come to our attention at all. As a consumer, it's hard to argue with blotting out the irrelevant and unlikable, but what is good for consumers is not necessarily good for citizens. What I seem to like may not be what I actually want, let alone what I need to know to be an informed member of my community or country. It's a civic virtue to be exposed to things that appear to be outside your interest, technology journalist Clive Thompson told me. In a complex world, almost everything affects you. That closes the loop on pecuniary self-interest. Cultural critic Lee Siegel puts it a different way. Customers are always right, but people aren't. The structure of our media affects the character of our society. The printed word is conducive to democratic argument in a way that laboriously copied scrolls aren't. Television had a profound effect on political life in the 20th century, from the Kennedy assassination to 9/11, and it's probably not a coincidence that a nation whose denizens spend 36 hours a week watching TV has less time for civic life. The era of personalization is here, and it's upending many of our predictions about what the Internet would do. The creators of the Internet envisioned something bigger and more important than a global system for sharing pictures of pets. The manifesto that helped launch the Electronic Frontier Foundation in the early 90s championed a civilization of mind in cyberspace, a kind of worldwide meta-brain. But personalized filters sever the synapses in that brain. Without knowing it, we may be giving ourselves a kind of global lobotomy instead. From megacities to nanotech, we're creating a global society whose complexity has passed the limits of individual comprehension. The problems we'll face in the next 20 years, energy shortages, terrorism, climate change, and disease, are enormous in scope. They're problems that we can only solve together. Early Internet enthusiasts, like web creator Tim Berners-Lee, hoped it would be a new platform for tackling those problems. I believe it still can be, and as you read on, I'll explain how. But first, we need to pull back the curtain to understand the forces that are taking the Internet in its current personalized direction. We need to lay bare the bugs in the code, and the coders, that brought personalization to us. If code is law, as Larry Lessig famously declared, it's important to understand what the new lawmakers are trying to do. We need to understand what the programmers at Google and Facebook believe in. We need to understand the economic and social forces that are driving personalization, some of which are inevitable and some of which are not. And we need to understand what all this means for our politics, our culture, and our future. Without sitting down next to a friend, it's hard to tell how the version of Google or Yahoo News that you're seeing differs from anyone else's. But because the filter bubble distorts our perception of what's important, true, and real, it's critically important to render it visible. That is what this book seeks to do. 1. The race for relevance. If you're not paying for something, you're not the customer, you're the product being sold. Andrew Lewis, under the alias Blue_Beetle on the website MetaFilter. In the spring of 1994, Nicholas Negroponte sat writing and thinking. At the MIT Media Lab, Negroponte's brainchild, young chip designers and virtual reality artists and robot wranglers were furiously at work building the toys and tools of the future. But Negroponte was mulling over a simple problem, one that millions of people pondered every day: what to watch on TV. By the mid-1990s, there were hundreds of channels streaming out live programming 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Most of the programming was horrendous and boring: infomercials for new kitchen gadgets, music videos for the latest one-hit wonder band, cartoons, and celebrity news. For any given viewer, only a tiny percentage of it was likely to be interesting. As the number of channels increased, The standard method of surfing through them was getting more and more hopeless. It's one thing to search through 5 channels, it's another to search through 500. And when the number hits 5,000, well, the method's useless. But Negroponte wasn't worried. All was not lost. In fact, a solution was just around the corner. The key to the future of television, he wrote, is to stop thinking about television as television, and to start thinking about it as a device with embedded intelligence. What consumers needed was a remote control that controls itself, an intelligent, automated helper that would learn what each viewer watches and capture the programs relevant to him or her. Today's TV set lets you control brightness, volume, and channel, Negroponte typed. Tomorrow's will allow you to vary sex, violence, and political leaning. And why stop there? Negroponte imagined a future swarming with intelligent agents to help with problems like the TV one. Like a personal butler at a door, the agents would let in only your favorite shows and topics. Imagine a future, Negroponte wrote, in which your interface agent can read every newswire and newspaper and catch every TV and radio broadcast on the planet, and then construct a personalized summary. This kind of newspaper is printed in an edition of one. Call it the Daily Me. The more he thought about it, the more sense it made. The solution to the information overflow of the digital age was smart, personalized, embedded editors. In fact, these agents didn't have to be limited to television. As he suggested to the editor of the new tech magazine, Wired, intelligent agents are the unequivocal future of computing. In San Francisco, Jaron Lanier responded to this argument with dismay. Lanier was one of the creators of virtual reality. Since the 80s, he'd been tinkering with how to bring computers and people together. But the talk of agents struck him as crazy. "What's got into all of you?" he wrote in a missive to the Wired-styled community on his website. "The idea of intelligent agents is both wrong and evil. The agent question looms as a deciding factor in whether the net will be much better than TV or much worse." Lanier was convinced that, because they're not actually people, agents would force actual humans to interact with them in awkward and pixelated ways. An agent's model of what you are interested in will be a cartoon model, and you will see a cartoon version of the world through the agent's eyes, he wrote. And there was another problem. The perfect agent would presumably screen out most or all advertising. But since online commerce was driven by advertising, it seemed unlikely that these companies would roll out agents who would do such violence to their bottom line. It was more likely, Lanier wrote, that these agents would have double loyalties, bribable agents. It's not clear who they're working for. It was a clear and plangent plea, but though it stirred up some chatter in online news groups, it didn't persuade the software giants of this early internet era. They were convinced by Negroponte's logic. The company that figured out how to sift through the digital haystack for the nuggets of gold would win the future. They could see the attention crash coming, as the information options available to each person rose toward infinity. If you wanted to cash in, you needed to get people to tune in. And in an attention-scarce world, the best way to do that was to provide content that really spoke to each person's idiosyncratic interests, desires, and needs. In the hallways and data centers of Silicon Valley, there was a new watchword: relevance. Everyone was rushing to roll out an intelligent product. In Redmond, Microsoft released Bob, a whole operating system based on the agent concept, anchored by a strange cartoonish avatar with an uncanny resemblance to Bill Gates. In Cupertino, almost exactly a decade before the iPhone, Apple introduced the Newton, a personal desktop assistant, whose core selling point was the agent lurking dutifully just under its beige surface. As it turned out, the new intelligent products bombed. In chat groups and on email lists, there was practically an industry of snark about Bob. Users couldn't stand it. PC World named it one of the 25 worst tech products of all time, and the Apple Newton didn't do much better. Though the company had invested over $100 million in developing the product, it sold poorly in the first 6 months of its existence. When you interacted with the intelligent agents of the mid-90s, the problem quickly became evident. They just weren't that smart. Now, a decade and change later, intelligent agents are still nowhere to be seen. It looks as though Negroponte's intelligent agent revolution failed. We don't wake up and brief an e-butler on our plans and desires for the day. But that doesn't mean they don't exist. They're just hidden. Personal intelligent agents lie under the surface of every website we go to. Every day they're getting smarter and more powerful, accumulating more information about who we are and what we're interested in. As Lanier predicted, the agents don't work only for us. They also work for software giants like Google, dispatching ads as well as content. Though they may lack Bob's cartoon face, they steer an increasing proportion of our online activity. In 1995, the race to provide personal relevance was just beginning. More than perhaps any other factor, it's this quest that has shaped the Internet we know today. The John Irving Problem. Jeff Bezos, the CEO of Amazon.com, was one of the first people to realize that you could harness the power of relevance to make a few billion dollars. Starting in 1994, his vision was to transport online bookselling back to the days of the small bookseller who got to know you very well and would say things like, "I know you like John Irving, and guess what? Here's this new author. I think he's a lot like John Irving," he told a biographer. But how to do that on a mass scale? To Bezos, Amazon needed to be a sort of a small artificial intelligence company, powered by algorithms capable of instantly matching customers and books. In 1994, as a young computer scientist working for Wall Street firms, Bezos had been hired by a venture capitalist to come up with business ideas for the burgeoning web space. He worked methodically, making a list of 20 products the team could theoretically sell online, music, clothing, electronics, and then digging into the dynamics of each industry. Books started at the bottom of his list, but when he drew up his final results, he was surprised to find them at the top. Books were ideal for a few reasons. For starters, the book industry was decentralized. The biggest publisher, Random House, controlled only 10% of the market. If one publisher wouldn't sell to him, there would be plenty of others who would. And people wouldn't need as much time to get comfortable with buying books online as they might with other products. A majority of book sales already happened outside of traditional bookstores, and unlike clothes, you didn't need to try them on. But the main reason books seemed attractive was simply the fact that there were so many of them. 3 million active titles in 1994 versus 300,000 active CDs. A physical bookstore would never be able to inventory all those books, but an online bookstore could. When he reported this finding to his boss, the investor wasn't interested. Books seemed like a kind of backward industry in an information age, but Bezos couldn't get the idea out of his head. Without a physical limit on the number of books he could stock, he could provide hundreds of thousands more titles than industry giants like Borders or Barnes & Noble, and at the same time, he could create a more intimate and personal experience than the big chains. Amazon's goal, he decided, would be to enhance the process of discovery. A personalized store that would help readers find books and introduce books to readers. But how? Bezos started thinking about machine learning. It was a tough problem, but a group of engineers and scientists had been attacking it at research institutions like MIT and the University of California at Berkeley since the 1950s. They called their field cybernetics, a word taken from Plato, who coined it to mean a self-regulating system, like a democracy. For the early cyberneticists, there was nothing more thrilling than building systems that tuned themselves based on feedback. Over the following decades, they laid the mathematical and theoretical foundations that would guide much of Amazon's growth. In 1990, a team of researchers at the Xerox Palo Alto Research Center, PARC, applied cybernetic thinking to a new problem. PARC was known for coming up with ideas that were broadly adopted and commercialized by others, the graphical user interface and the mouse, to mention two. And like many cutting-edge technologists at the time, the PARC researchers were early power users of email. They sent and received hundreds of them. Email was great, but the downside was quickly obvious. When it costs nothing to send a message to as many people as you like, you can quickly get buried in a flood of useless information. To keep up with the flow, the PARC team started tinkering with a process they called collaborative filtering, which ran in a program called Tapestry. Tapestry tracked how people reacted to the mass emails they received, which items they opened, which ones they responded to, and which they deleted, and then used this information to help order the inbox. Emails that people had engaged with a lot would move to the top of the list. Emails that were frequently deleted or unopened would go to the bottom. In essence, collaborative filtering was a time saver. Instead of having to sift through the pile of email yourself, you could rely on others to help pre-sift the items you'd received. And of course, you didn't have to use it just for email. Tapestry, its creators wrote, is designed to handle any incoming stream of electronic documents. Electronic mail is only one example of such a stream. Others are newswire stories and net news articles. Tapestry had introduced collaborative filtering to the world, but in 1990, the world wasn't very interested. With only a few million users, the internet was still a small ecosystem, and there just wasn't much information to sort or much bandwidth to download with. So, for years, collaborative filtering remained the domain of software researchers and bored college students. If you emailed ringo@media.mit.edu in 1994 with some albums you liked, the service would send an email back with other music recommendations and the reviews. Once an hour, according to the website, the server processes all incoming messages and sends replies as necessary. It was an early precursor to Pandora. It was a personalized music service for a pre-broadband era. But when Amazon launched in 1995, everything changed. From the start, Amazon was a bookstore with personalization built in. By watching which books people bought and using the collaborative filtering methods pioneered at PARC, Amazon could make recommendations on the fly. Oh, you're getting The Complete Dummy's Guide to Fencing? How about adding a copy of Waking Up Blind, Lawsuits Over Eye Injury? And by tracking which users bought what over time, Amazon could start to see which users' preferences were similar. Other people who have similar tastes to yours bought this week's new release, En Garde. The more people bought books from Amazon, the better the personalization got. In 1997, Amazon had sold books to its first 1 million customers. 6 months later, it had served 2 million. And in 2001, it reported its first quarterly net profit, one of the first businesses to prove that there was serious money to be made online. If Amazon wasn't quite able to create the feeling of a local bookstore, its personalization code nonetheless worked quite well. Amazon executives are tight-lipped about just how much revenue is brought in, but they often point to the personalization engine as a key part of the company's success. At Amazon, The push for more user data is never-ending. When you read books on your Kindle, the data about which phrases you highlight, which pages you turn, and whether you read straight through or skip around are all fed back into Amazon's servers and can be used to indicate what books you might like next. When you log in after a day reading Kindle e-books at the beach, Amazon is able to subtly customize its site to appeal to what you've read. If you've spent a lot of time with the latest James Patterson, but only glanced at that new diet guide, you might see more commercial thrillers and fewer health books. Amazon users have gotten so used to personalization that the site now uses a reverse trick to make some additional cash. Publishers pay for placement in physical bookstores, but they can't buy the opinions of the clerks. But as Lanier predicted, buying off algorithms is easy. Pay enough to Amazon, and your book can be promoted as if by an objective recommendation by Amazon software. For most customers, it's impossible to tell which is which. Amazon proved that relevance could lead to industry dominance, but it would take two Stanford graduate students to apply the principles of machine learning to the whole world of online information. Click signals. As Jeff Bezos's new company was getting off the ground, Larry Page and Sergey Brin, the founders of Google, were busy doing their doctoral research at Stanford. They were aware of Amazon's success. In 1997, the dot-com bubble was in full swing, and Amazon, on paper at least, was worth billions. Page and Brin were math whizzes. Page, especially, was obsessed with AI. But they were interested in a different problem. Instead of using algorithms to figure out how to sell products more effectively, what if you could use them to sort through sites on the web? Page had come up with a novel approach, and with a geeky predilection for puns, he called it PageRank. Most web search companies at the time sorted pages using keywords and were very poor at figuring out which page for a given word was the most relevant. In a 1997 paper, Brin and Page dryly pointed out that three of the four major search engines couldn't find themselves. We want our notion of relevant to only include the very best documents, they wrote, since there may be tens of thousands of slightly relevant documents. Page had realized that packed into the linked structure of the web was a lot more data than most search engines made use of. The fact that a web page linked to another page could be considered a vote for that page. At Stanford, Page had seen professors count how many times their papers had been cited as a rough index of how important they were. Like academic papers, he realized, the pages that a lot of other pages cite, say the front page of Yahoo, could be assumed to be more important, and the pages that those pages voted for would matter more. The process, Page argued, utilized the uniquely democratic structure of the web. In those early days, Google lived at google.stanford.edu, and Brin and Page were convinced it should be non-profit and advertising-free. We expect that advertising-funded search engines will be inherently biased toward the advertisers and away from the needs of the consumers, they wrote. The better the search engine is, the fewer advertisements will be needed for the consumer to find what they want. We believe the issue of advertising causes enough mixed incentives that it is crucial to have a competitive search engine that is transparent and in the academic realm. But when they released the beta site into the wild, the traffic chart went vertical. Google worked. Out of the box, it was the best search site on the internet. Soon, the temptation to spin it off as a business was too great for the 20-something co-founders to bear. In the Google mythology, it is PageRank that drove the company to worldwide dominance. I suspect the company likes it that way. It's a simple, clear story that hangs the search giant's success on a single ingenious breakthrough by one of its founders. But from the beginning, PageRank was just a small part of the Google project. What Brin and Page had really figured out was this: the key to relevance, the solution to sorting through the mass of data on the web, was more data. It wasn't just which pages linked to which that Brin and Page were interested in. The position of a link on the page, the size of the link, the age of the page, all of these factors mattered. Over the years, Google has come to call these clues embedded in the data signals. From the beginning, Page and Brin realized that some of the most important signals would come from the search engine's users. If someone searches for Larry Page, say, and clicks on the second link, that's another kind of vote. It suggests that the second link is more relevant to that searcher than the first one. They called this a click signal. Some of the most interesting research, Page and Brin wrote, will involve leveraging the vast amount of usage data that is available from modern web systems. It is very difficult to get this data, mainly because it is considered commercially valuable. Soon, they'd be sitting on one of the world's largest stores of it. Where data was concerned, Google was voracious. Brin and Page were determined to keep everything. Every web page the search engine had ever landed on, every click every user ever made. Soon its servers contained a nearly real-time copy of most of the web. By sifting through this data, they were certain they'd find more clues, more signals that could be used to tweak results. The search quality division at the company acquired a black ops kind of feel. Few visitors and absolute secrecy were the rule. The ultimate search engine, Page was fond of saying, would understand exactly what you mean and give back exactly what you want. Google didn't want to return thousands of pages of links. It wanted to return one, the one you wanted. But the perfect answer for one person isn't perfect for another. When I search for panthers, what I probably mean are the large wild cats, whereas a football fan searching for the phrase probably means the Carolina team. To provide perfect relevance, you'd need to know what each of us was interested in. You'd need to know that I'm pretty clueless about football. You'd need to know who I was. The challenge was getting enough data to figure out what's personally relevant to each user. Understanding what someone means is tricky business, and to do it well, you have to get to know a person's behavior over a sustained period of time. But how? In 2004, Google came up with an innovative strategy. It started providing other services, services that required users to log in. Gmail, its hugely popular email service, was one of the first to roll out. The press focused on the ads that ran along Gmail's sidebar, but it's unlikely that those ads were the sole motive for launching the service. By getting people to log in, Google got its hands on an enormous pile of data, the hundreds of millions of emails Gmail users send and receive each day. And it could cross-reference each user's email and behavior on the site with the links he or she clicked in the Google search engine. Google Apps, a suite of online word processing and spreadsheet creation tools, served double duty. It undercut Microsoft, Google's sworn enemy, and it provided yet another hook for people to stay logged in and continue sending click signals. All this data allowed Google to accelerate the process of building a theory of identity for each user, what topics each user was interested in, what links each person clicked. By November 2008, Google had several patents for personalization algorithms, code that could figure out the groups to which an individual belongs and tailor his or her result to suit that group's preference. The categories Google had in mind were pretty narrow. To illustrate its example in the patent, Google used the example of all persons interested in collecting ancient shark teeth and all persons not interested in collecting ancient shark teeth. People in the former category who searched for, say, great white incisors would get different results from the latter. Today, Google monitors every signal about us it can get its hands on. The power of this data can't be underestimated. If Google sees that I log on first from New York, then from San Francisco, then from New York again, it knows I'm a bi-coastal traveler and can adjust its results accordingly. By looking at what browser I use, it can make some guesses about my age and even perhaps my politics. How much time you take between the moment you enter your query and the moment you click on a result sheds light on your personality. And, of course, the terms you search for reveal a tremendous amount about your interests. Even if you're not logged in, Google is personalizing your search. The neighborhood, even the block, that you're logging in from is available to Google, and it says a lot about who you are and what you're interested in. A query for socks coming from Wall Street is probably shorthand for the financial legislation Sarbanes-Oxley, while across the Upper Bay in Staten Island, it's probably about baseball. People always make the assumption that we're done with search, said founder Page in 2009. That's very far from the case. We're probably only 5% of the way there. We want to create the ultimate search engine that can understand anything. Some people could call that artificial intelligence. In 2006, at an event called Google Press Day, CEO Eric Schmidt laid out Google's 5-year plan. One day, he said, Google would be able to answer questions such as, which college should I go to? It will be some years before we can at least partially answer those questions, but the eventual outcome is that Google can answer a more hypothetical question.
This is the end of the CD. The audiobook continues on the next CD.
Facebook everywhere. Google's algorithms were unparalleled, but the challenge was to coax users into revealing their tastes and interests. In February 2004, working out of his Harvard dorm room, Mark Zuckerberg came up with an easier approach. Rather than sifting through click signals to figure out what people cared about, the plan behind his creation, Facebook, was to just flat out ask them. Since he was a college freshman, Zuckerberg had been interested in what he called the social graph, the set of each person's relationships. Feed a computer that data, and it could start to do some pretty interesting and useful things, telling you what your friends were up to, where they were, and what they were interested in. It also had implications for news. In its earliest incarnation as a Harvard-only site, Facebook automatically annotated people's personal pages with links to the Crimson articles in which they appeared. Facebook was hardly the first social network. As Zuckerberg was hacking together his creation in the wee hours of the morning, a hairy, music-driven site named MySpace was soaring. Before MySpace, Friendster had, for a brief moment, captured the attention of the technorati. But the website Zuckerberg had in mind was different. It wouldn't be a coy dating site like Friendster. And unlike MySpace, which encouraged people to connect whether they knew each other or not, Facebook was about taking advantage of existing real-world social connections. Compared to its predecessors, Facebook was stripped down. The emphasis was on information, not flashy graphics or a cultural vibe. We're a utility, Zuckerberg said later. Facebook was less like a nightclub than a phone company, a neutral platform for communication and collaboration. Even in its first incarnation, the site grew like wildfire. After Facebook expanded to a few select Ivy League campuses, Zuckerberg's inbox was flooded with requests from students on other campuses, begging him to turn on Facebook for them. By May of 2005, the site was up and running at over 800 colleges, but it was the development of the news feed the following September that pushed Facebook into another league. On Friendster and MySpace, to find out what your friends were up to, you had to visit their pages. The newsfeed algorithm pulled all of these updates out of Facebook's massive database and placed them in one place, up front, right when you logged in. Overnight, Facebook had turned itself from a network of connected web pages into a personalized newspaper featuring and created by your friends. It's hard to imagine a purer source of relevance. And it was a gusher. In 2006, Facebook users posted literally billions of updates, philosophical quotes, tidbits about who they were dating, what was for breakfast. Zuckerberg and his team egged them on. The more data users handed over to the company, the better their experience could be, and the more they'd keep coming back. Early on, they'd added the ability to upload photos, and now Facebook had the largest photo collection in the world. They encouraged users to post links from other websites, and millions were submitted. By 2007, Zuckerberg bragged, "We're actually producing more news in a single day for our 19 million users than any other media outlet has in its entire existence." At first, the news feed showed nearly everything your friends did on the site. But as the volume of posts and friends increased, the feed became unreadable and unmanageable. Even if you had only 100 friends, it was too much to read. Facebook's solution was EdgeRank, the algorithm that powers the default page on the site, the top news feed. EdgeRank ranks every interaction on the site. The math is complicated, but the basic idea is pretty simple, and it rests on three factors. The first is affinity. The friendlier you are with someone, as determined by the amount of time you spend interacting and checking out his or her profile, the more likely it is that Facebook will show you that person's updates. The second is the relative weight of that type of content. Relationship status updates, for example, are weighted very highly. Everybody likes to know who's dating whom. Many outsiders suspect that the weight, too, is personalized. Different people care about different kinds of content. The third is time. Recently posted items are weighted over older ones. EdgeRank demonstrates the paradox at the core of the race for relevancy. To provide relevance, personalization algorithms need data. But the more data there is, the more sophisticated the filters must become to organize it. It's a never-ending cycle. By 2009, Facebook had hit the 300 million user mark and was growing by 10 million people per month. Zuckerberg, at 25, was a paper billionaire. But the company had bigger ambitions. What the news feed had done for social information, Zuckerberg wanted to do for all information. Though he never said it, the goal was clear. Leveraging the social graph and the masses of information Facebook's users had provided, Zuckerberg wanted to put Facebook's news algorithm engine at the center of the web. Even so, it was a surprise when, on April 21, 2010, readers loaded the Washington Post homepage and discovered that their friends were on it. In a prominent box in the upper right corner, the place where any editor will tell you the eye lands first, was a feature titled Network News. Each person who visited saw a different set of links in the box, the Washington Post links their friends had shared on Facebook. The Post was letting Facebook edit its most valuable online asset, its front page. The New York Times soon followed suit. The new feature was one piece of a much bigger rollout, which Facebook called Facebook Everywhere, and announced at its annual conference F8, Fate. Ever since Steve Jobs sold the Apple by calling it insanely great, a measure of grandiosity has been part of the Silicon Valley tradition. But when Zuckerberg walked onto the stage on April 21, 2010, his words seemed plausible. "This is the most transformative thing we've ever done for the web," he announced. The aim of Facebook Everywhere was simple: make the whole web social and bring Facebook-style personalization to millions of sites that currently lack it. Want to know what music your Facebook friends are listening to? Pandora would now tell you. Want to know what restaurants your friends like? Yelp now had the answer. News sites from the Huffington Post to the Washington Post were now personalized. Facebook made it possible to press the like button on any item on the web. In the first 24 hours of the new service, there were 1 billion likes, and all of that data flowed back into Facebook's servers. Brett Taylor, Facebook's platform lead, announced that users were sharing 25 billion items a month. Google, once the undisputed leader in the push for relevance, seemed worried about the rival a few miles down the road. The two giants are now in hand-to-hand combat. Facebook poaches key executives from Google. Google's hard at work constructing social software like Facebook. But it's not totally obvious why the two new media monoliths should be at war. Google, after all, is built around answering questions. Facebook's core mission is to help people connect with their friends. But both businesses' bottom lines depend on the same thing: targeted, highly relevant advertising. The contextual advertisements Google places next to search results and on web pages are its only significant source of profits. And while Facebook's finances are private, insiders have made clear that advertising is at the core of the company's revenue model. Google and Facebook have different starting points and different strategies. One starts with the relationships among pieces of information, while the other starts with the relationships among people. But ultimately, they're competing for the same advertising dollars. From the point of view of the online advertiser, the question is simple. Which company can deliver the most return on a dollar spent? And this is where relevance comes back into the equation. The masses of data Facebook and Google accumulate have two uses. For users, the data provides a key to providing personally relevant news and results. For advertisers, the data is the key to finding likely buyers. The company that has the most data and can put it to the best use gets the advertising dollars. Which brings us to lock-in. Lock-in is the point at which users are so invested in their technology that even if competitors might offer better services, it's not worth making the switch. If you're a Facebook member, think about what it'd take to get you to switch to another social networking site, even if the site had vastly greater features. It'd probably take a lot. Recreating your whole profile, uploading all of those pictures, and laboriously entering your friends' names would be extremely tedious. You're pretty locked in. Likewise, Gmail, GChat, Google Voice, Google Docs, and a host of other products are part of an orchestrated campaign for Google lock-in. The fight between Google and Facebook hinges on which can achieve lock-in for the most users. The dynamics of lock-in are described by Metcalfe's Law, a principle coined by Bob Metcalfe, the inventor of the Ethernet protocol that wires together computers. The law says that the usefulness of a network increases at an accelerating rate as you add each new person to it. It's not much use to be the only person you know with a fax machine, but if everyone you work with uses one, it's a huge disadvantage not to be in the loop. Lock-in is the dark side of Metcalfe's law. Facebook is useful in large part because everyone's on it. It'd take a lot of mismanagement to overcome that basic fact. The more locked in users are, the easier it is to convince them to log in. And when you're constantly logged in, these companies can keep tracking data on you even when you're not visiting their websites. If you're logged into Gmail and you visit a website that uses Google's DoubleClick ad service, that fact can be attached to your Google account. And with tracking cookies these services place on your computer, Facebook or Google can provide ads based on your personal information on third-party sites. The whole web can become a platform for Google or Facebook. But Google and Facebook are hardly the only options. The daily turf warfare between Google and Facebook occupies scores of business reporters and gigabytes of blog chatter, but there's a stealthy third front opening up in this war. And though most of the companies involved operate under the radar, they may ultimately represent the future of personalization. The data market. The manhunt for accomplices of the 9/11 killers was one of the most extensive in history. In the immediate aftermath of the attacks, the scope of the plot was unclear. Were there more hijackers who hadn't yet been found? How extensive was the network that had pulled off the attacks? For 3 days, the CIA, FBI, and a host of other acronymed agencies worked around the clock to identify who else was involved. The country's planes were grounded, its airports closed. When help arrived, it came from an unlikely place. On September 14th, the Bureau had released the names of the hijackers, and it was now asking, pleading, for anyone with information about the perpetrators to come forward. Later that day, the FBI received a call from Mac McLarty, a former White House official who sat on the board of a little-known but hugely profitable company called Axiom. As soon as the hijackers' names had been publicly released, Axiom had searched its massive databanks, which take up 5 acres in tiny Conway, Arkansas, and it had found some very interesting data on the perpetrators of the attacks. In fact, it turned out, Axiom knew more about 11 of the 19 hijackers than the entire U.S. government did, including their past and current addresses and the names of their housemates. We may never know what was in the files Axiom gave the government, though one of the executives told a reporter that Axiom's information had led to deportations and indictments. But here's what Axiom knows about 96% of American households and 500 million people worldwide. The names of their family members, their current and past addresses, how often they pay their credit card bills, whether they own a dog or a cat, and what breed it is, whether they are right-handed or left-handed, what kind of medications they use, based on pharmacy records. The list of data points is about 1,500 items long. Axiom keeps a low profile. It may not be an accident that its name is nearly unpronounceable, but it serves most of the largest companies in America. 9 of the 10 major credit card companies and consumer brands from Microsoft to Blockbuster. Think of Axiom as an automated factory, one engineer told a reporter, where the product we make is data. To get a sense of Axiom's vision for the future, consider a travel search site like Travelocity or Kayak. Ever wondered how they make money? Kayak makes money in 2 ways. One is pretty simple, a holdover from the era of travel agents. When you buy a flight using a link from Kayak, airlines pay the site a small fee for the referral. The other is much less obvious. When you search for the flight, Kayak places a cookie on your computer, a small file that's basically like putting a sticky note on your forehead saying, "Tell me about cheap bi-coastal fares." Kayak can then sell that piece of data to a company like Axiom or its rival, Blue Kai, which auctions it off to the company with the highest bid, in this case, probably a major airline like United. Once it knows what kind of trip you're interested in, United can show you ads for relevant flights, not just on Kayak's site, but on literally almost any website you visit across the internet. This whole process, from the collection of your data to the sale to United, takes under a second. The champions of this practice call it behavioral retargeting. Retailers noticed that 98% of visitors to online shopping sites leave without buying anything. Retargeting means businesses no longer have to take no for an answer. Say you check out a pair of running sneakers online, but leave the site without springing for them. If the shoe site you were looking at uses retargeting, their ads, maybe displaying a picture of the exact sneaker you were just considering, will follow you around the internet, showing up next to the scores from last night's game or posts on your favorite blog. And if you finally break down and buy the sneakers, well, the shoe site can sell that piece of information to Blue Kai to auction it off to, say, an athletic apparel site. Pretty soon, you'll be seeing ads all over the internet for sweat-wicking socks. This kind of persistent, personalized advertising isn't just confined to your computer. Sites like Looped and Foursquare, which broadcast a user's location from her mobile phone, provide advertisers with opportunities to reach consumers with targeted ads, even when they're out and about. Looped is working on an ad system whereby stores can offer special discounts and promotions to repeat customers on their phones, right as they walk through the door. And if you sit down on a Southwest Airlines flight, the ads on your seatback TV screen may be different from your neighbors. Southwest, after all, knows your name and who you are. And by cross-indexing that personal information with a database like Axiom's, it can know a whole lot more about you. Why not show you your own ads, or for that matter, a targeted show that makes you more likely to watch them? Targus Info, another of the new firms that processes this sort of information, brags that it delivers more than 62 billion real-time attributes a year. That's 62 billion points of data about who customers are, what they're doing, and what they want. Another ominously named enterprise, the Rubicon Project, claims that its database includes more than 500 million internet users. For now, retargeting is being used by advertisers, but there's no reason to expect that publishers and content providers won't get in on it. After all, if the Los Angeles Times knows that you're a fan of Perez Hilton, it can front page its interview with him in your edition, which means you'll be more likely to stay on the site and click around. What all of this means is that your behavior is now a commodity, a tiny piece of a market that provides a platform for the personalization of the whole internet. We're used to thinking of the web as a series of one-to-one relationships. You manage your relationship with Yahoo separately from your relationship with your favorite blog. But behind the scenes, the web is becoming increasingly integrated. Businesses are realizing that it's profitable to share data. Thanks to Axiom and the data market, sites can put the most relevant products up front and whisper to each other behind your back. The push for relevance gave rise to today's internet giants, and it is motivating businesses to accumulate ever more data about us and to invisibly tailor our online experiences on that basis. It's changing the fabric of the web. But, as we'll see, the consequences of personalization for how we consume news, make political decisions, and even how we think will be even more dramatic. 2. The user is the content. Everything which bars freedom and fullness of communication sets up barriers that divide human beings into sets and cliques, into antagonistic sects and factions, and thereby undermines the democratic way of life. John Dewey. The technology will be so good, it will be very hard for people to watch or consume something that has not in some sense been tailored for them. Eric Schmidt, Google CEO. Microsoft Building 1 in Mountain View, California, is a long, low, gunmetal gray hangar, and if it weren't for the cars buzzing by behind it on Highway 101, you'd almost be able to hear the whine of ultrasonic security. On this Saturday in 2010, the vast expanses of parking lot were empty, except for a few dozen BMWs and Volvos, a cluster of scrubby pine trees bent in the gusty wind. Inside, the concrete-floored hallways were crawling with CEOs in jeans and blazers, trading business cards over coffee and swapping stories about deals. Most hadn't come far. The startups they represented were based nearby. Hovering over the cheese spread was a group of executives from data firms like Axiom and Experian, who had flown in from Arkansas and New York the night before. With fewer than 100 people in attendance, The Social Graph Symposium nonetheless included the leaders and luminaries of the targeted marketing field. A bell rang, the group filed into breakout rooms, and one of the conversations quickly turned to the battle to monetize content. The picture, the group agreed, didn't look good for newspapers. The contours of the situation were clear to anyone paying attention. The internet had delivered a number of mortal blows to the newspaper business model, any one of which might be fatal. Craigslist had made classified advertisements free, and $18 billion in revenue went poof. Nor was online advertising picking up the slack. An advertising pioneer once famously said, "Half the money I spend on advertising is wasted. I just don't know which half." But the internet turned that logic on its head. With click-through rates and other metrics, businesses suddenly knew exactly which half of their money went to waste. And when ads didn't work as well as the industry had promised, advertising budgets were cut accordingly. Meanwhile, bloggers and freelance journalists started to package and produce news content for free, which pressured the papers to do the same online. But what most interested the crowd in the room was the fact that the entire premise on which the news business had been built was changing, and the publishers weren't even paying attention. The New York Times had traditionally been able to command high ad rates because advertisers knew it attracted a premium audience, the wealthy opinion-making elite of New York and beyond. In fact, the publisher had a near monopoly on reaching that group. There were only a few other outlets that provided a direct feed into their homes and out of their pocketbooks. Now all that was changing. One executive in the marketing session was especially blunt. "The publishers are losing," he said, "and they will lose because they just don't get it." Instead of taking out expensive advertisements in the New York Times, it was now possible to track that elite cosmopolitan readership using data acquired from Axiom or Blue Sky. This was, to say the least, a game changer in the business of news. Advertisers no longer needed to pay the New York Times to reach Times readers. They could target them wherever they went online. The era where you had to develop premium content to get premium audiences, in other words, was coming to a close. The numbers said it all. In 2003, publishers of articles and videos online received most of each dollar advertisers spent on their sites. Now, in 2010, they only received 20 cents. The difference was moving to the people who had the data, many of whom were in attendance at Mountain View. A PowerPoint presentation circulating in the industry called out the significance of this change succinctly, describing how premium publishers were losing a key advantage because advertisers can now target premium audiences in other, cheaper places. The take-home message was clear. Users, not sites, were now the focus. Unless newspapers could think of themselves as behavioral data companies with a mission of churning out information about their readers' preferences, unless, in other words, they could adapt themselves to the personalized filter bubble world, they were sunk. News shapes our sense of the world, of what's important, of the scale and color and character of our problems. More important, it provides the foundation of shared experience and shared knowledge on which democracy is built. Unless we understand the big problems our societies face, we can't act together to fix them. Walter Lippmann, the father of modern journalism, put it more eloquently. All that the sharpest critics of democracy have alleged is true, if there is no steady supply of trustworthy and relevant news. Incompetence and aimlessness, corruption and disloyalty, panic and ultimate disaster must come to any people which is denied an assured access to the facts. If news matters, newspapers matter, because their journalists write most of it. Although the majority of Americans get their news from local and national TV broadcasts, most of the actual reporting and story generation happens in newspaper newsrooms. They're the core creators of the news economy. Even in 2010, blogs remain incredibly reliant on them. According to Pew Research Center's Project for Excellence in Journalism, 99% of the stories linked to in blog posts came from newspapers and broadcast networks, and the New York Times and Washington Post alone account for nearly 50% of all blog links. While rising in importance and influence, net native media still mostly lack the capacity to shape public life that these papers and a few other outlets like the BBC and CNN have. But the shift is coming. The forces unleashed by the Internet are driving a radical transformation in who produces news and how they do it. Whereas once you had to buy the whole paper to get the sports section, now you can go to a sports-only website with enough new content each day to fill 10 papers. Whereas once only those who could buy ink by the barrel could reach an audience of millions, now anyone with a laptop and a fresh idea can. If we look carefully, we can begin to project the outline of the new constellation that's emerging. This much we know. The cost of producing and distributing media of all kinds, words, images, video, and audio streams, will continue to fall closer and closer to zero. As a result, we'll be deluged with choices of what to pay attention to, and we'll continue to suffer from attention crash. This makes curators all the more important. We'll rely ever more heavily on human and software curators to determine what news we should consume. Professional human editors are expensive, and code is cheap. Increasingly, we'll rely on a mix of non-professional editors, our friends and colleagues, and software code to figure out what to watch, read, and see. This code will draw heavily on the power of personalization and displace professional human editors. Many Internet watchers, myself included, cheered the development of people-powered news, a more democratic, participatory form of cultural storytelling. But the future may be more machine-powered than people-powered. And many of the breakthrough champions of the people-powered viewpoint tell us more about our current transitional reality than the news of the future. The story of Rathergate is a classic example of the problem. When CBS News announced 9 weeks before the 2004 election that it had papers proving that President Bush had manipulated his military record, the assertion seemed as though it might be the turning point for the Kerry campaign, which had been running behind in the polls. The viewership for 60 Minutes Wednesday was high. Tonight, we have new documents and new information on the president's military service and the first ever interview with the man who says he pulled the strings to get young George W. Bush into the Texas Air National Guard, Dan Rather said somberly as he laid out the facts. That night, as the New York Times was preparing its headline on the story, a lawyer and conservative activist named Harry McDougald posted to a right-wing forum called FreeRepublic.com. After looking closely at the typeface of the documents, McDougald was convinced that there was something fishy going on. He didn't beat around the bush. "I'm saying these documents are forgeries, run through a copier for 15 generations to make them look old," he wrote. "This should be pursued aggressively." McDougald's post quickly attracted attention, and the discussion about the forgeries jumped to two other blog communities, Powerline and Little Green Footballs, where readers quickly discovered other anachronistic quirks. By the next afternoon, the influential Drudge Report had the campaign reporters talking about the validity of the documents. And the following day, September 10th, the Associated Press, New York Times, Washington Post, and other outlets all carried the story. CBS's scoop might not be true. By September 20th, the president of CBS News had issued a statement on the documents. "Based on what we now know, CBS News cannot prove that the documents are authentic. We should not have used them." While the full truth of Bush's military record never came to light, Rather, one of the most prominent journalists in the world retired in disgrace the next year. Rathergate is now an enduring part of the mythology about the way blogs and the internet have changed the game of journalism. No matter where you stand on the politics involved, it's an inspiring tale. McDougald, an activist on a home computer, discovered the truth, took down one of the biggest figures in journalism, and changed the course of an election. But this version of the story omits a critical point. In the 12 days between CBS's airing of the story and its public acknowledgement that the documents were probably fakes, the rest of the broadcast news media turned out reams of reportage. The Associated Press and USA Today hired professional document reviewers who scrutinized every dot and character. Cable news networks issued breathless updates. A striking 65% of Americans and nearly 100% of the political and reportorial classes were paying attention to the story. It is only because these news sources reached many of the same people who watch CBS News that CBS could not afford to ignore the story. McDougald and his allies may have lit the match, but it took print and broadcast media to fan the flames into a career-burning conflagration. Rathergate, in other words, is a good story about how online and broadcast media can interact, but it tells us little or nothing about how news will move once the broadcast era is fully over, and we're moving toward that moment at a breakneck pace. The question we have to ask is, what does news look like in the post-broadcast world? How does it move, and what impact does it have? If the power to shape news rests in the hands of bits of code, not professional human editors, is the code up to the task? If the news environment becomes so fragmented that McDougald's discovery can't reach a broad audience, could Rathergate even happen at all? Before we can answer that question, it's worth quickly reviewing where our current news system came from. The rise and fall of the general audience. Lippmann, in 1920, wrote that the crisis in Western democracy is a crisis in journalism. The two are inextricably linked, and to understand the future of this relationship, we have to understand its past. It's hard to imagine that there was a time when public opinion didn't exist, but as late as the mid-1700s, politics was palace politics. Newspapers confined themselves to commercial and foreign news. A report from a frigate in Brussels and a letter from a nobleman in Vienna set in type and sold to the commercial classes of London. Only when the modern, complex, centralized state emerged, with private individuals rich enough to lend money to the king, did forward-looking officials realize that the views of the people outside the walls had begun to matter. The rise of the public realm, and news as its medium, was partly driven by the emergence of new complex societal problems, from the transport of water to the challenges of empire, that transcended the narrow bounds of individual experience. But technological changes also made an impact. After all, how news is conveyed profoundly shapes what is conveyed. While the spoken word is always directed to a specific audience, the written word, and especially the printing press, changed all that. In a real sense, it made the general audience possible. This ability to address a broad, anonymous group fueled the Enlightenment era, and thanks to the printing press, scientists and scholars could spread complex ideas with perfect precision to an audience spread over large distances. And because everyone was literally on the same page, transnational conversations began that would have been impossibly laborious in the earlier scribe-driven epoch. In the American colonies, the printing industry developed at a fierce clip. At the time of the Revolution, there was no other place in the world with such a density and variety of newspapers. And while they catered exclusively to the interests of white male landowners, the newspapers nonetheless provided a common language and common arguments for dissent. Thomas Paine's rallying cry, "Common Sense," helped give the diverse colonies a sense of mutual interest and solidarity. Early newspapers existed to provide business owners with information about market prices and conditions, and newspapers depended on subscription and advertising revenues to survive. It wasn't until the 1830s and the rise of the penny press, cheap newspapers sold as one-offs on the street, that everyday citizens in the United States became a primary constituency for news. It was at this point that newspapers came to carry what we think of as news today. The small aristocratic public was transforming into a general public. The middle class was growing, and because middle class people had both a day-to-day stake in the life of the nation and the time and money to spend on entertainment, they were hungry for news and spectacle. Circulation skyrocketed, and as education levels went up, more people came to understand the interconnected nature of modern society. If what happened in Russia could affect prices in New York, it was worth following the news from Russia. But though democracy and the newspaper were becoming ever more intertwined, the relationship wasn't an easy one. After World War I, tensions about what role the newspaper should play boiled over, becoming a matter of great debate among two of the leading intellectual lights of the time, Walter Lippmann and John Dewey. Lippmann had watched with disgust as newspapers had effectively joined the propaganda effort for World War I. In Liberty and the News, a book of essays published in 1921, he angrily assailed the industry. He quoted an editor who had written that in the service of the war, governments conscripted public opinion. They goose-stepped it. They taught it to stand at attention and salute. Lippmann wrote that so long as newspapers existed and they determined by entirely private and unexamined standards, no matter how lofty, what the average citizen shall know, and hence what he shall believe, no one will be able to say that the substance of democratic government is secure. Over the next decade, Lippmann advanced his line of thought. Public opinion, Lippmann concluded, was too malleable. People were easily manipulated and led by false information. In 1925, he wrote The Phantom Public, an attempt to dismantle the illusion of a rational, informed populace once and for all. Lippmann argued against the prevailing democratic mythology, in which informed citizens capably made decisions about the major issues of the day. The omnicompetent citizens that such a system required were nowhere to be found. At best, ordinary citizens could be trusted to vote out the party that was in power if it was doing too poorly. The real work of governance, Lippmann argued, should be entrusted to insider experts who had education and expertise to see what was really going on. John Dewey, one of the great philosophers of democracy, couldn't pass up the opportunity to engage. In The Public and Its Problems, a series of lectures Dewey gave in response to Lippmann's book, he admitted that many of Lippmann's critiques were not wrong. The media were able to easily manipulate what people thought. Citizens were hardly informed enough to properly govern. However, Dewey argued, to accept Lippmann's proposal was to give up on the promise of democracy, an ideal that had not yet fully been realized, but might still be. To learn to be human, Dewey argued, is to develop through the give and take of communication an effective sense of being an individually distinctive member of a community. The institutions of the 1920s, Dewey said, were closed off. They didn't invite democratic participation. But journalists and newspapers could play a critical role in this process by calling out the citizen in people, reminding them of their stake in the nation's business. While they disagreed on the contours of the solution, Dewey and Lippmann did fundamentally agree that newsmaking was a fundamentally political and ethical enterprise, and that publishers had to handle their immense responsibility with great care. And because the newspapers of the time were making money hand over fist, they could afford to listen. At Lippmann's urging, the more credible papers built a wall between the business portion of their papers and the reporting side. they began to champion objectivity and decry tilted reporting. It's this ethical model, one in which newspapers have a responsibility to both neutrally inform and convene the public, which guided the aspirations of journalistic endeavors for the last half century. Of course, news agencies have frequently fallen short of these lofty goals, and it's not always clear how hard they even try. Spectacle and profit-seeking frequently win out over good journalistic practice. Media empires make reporting decisions to placate advertisers, and not every outlet that proclaims itself fair and balanced actually is. Thanks to critics like Lippmann, the present system has a sense of ethics and public responsibility baked in, however imperfectly. But though it's playing some of the same roles, the filter bubble does not. A new middleman. New York Times critic John Perelis calls the 2000s the disintermediation decade. Disintermediation, the elimination of middlemen, is the thing that the internet does to every business, art, and profession that aggregates and repackages, wrote proto-blogger Dave Weiner in 2005. The great virtue of the internet is that it erodes power, says the internet pioneer Esther Dyson. It sucks power out of the center and takes it to the periphery. It erodes the power of institutions over people while giving to individuals the power to run their own lives. The disintermediation story was repeated hundreds of times, on blogs, in academic papers, and on talk shows. In one familiar version, it goes like this. Once upon a time, newspaper editors woke up in the morning, went to work, and decided what we should think. They could do this because printing presses were expensive, but it became their explicit ethos. As newspapermen, it was their paternalistic duty to feed the citizenry a healthy diet of coverage. Many of them meant well, but living in New York and Washington, D.C., they were enthralled by the trappings of power. They counted success by the number of insider cocktail parties they were invited to, and the coverage followed suit. The editors and journalists became embedded in the culture they were supposed to cover, and as a result, powerful people got off the hook, and the interests of the media tilted against the interests of everyday folk, who were at their mercy. Then the internet came along and disintermediated the news. All of a sudden, you didn't have to rely on the Washington Post's interpretation of the White House press briefing. You could look up the transcript yourself. The middleman dropped out, not just in news, but in music. No more need for Rolling Stone. You could now hear directly from your favorite band. And commerce. You could follow the Twitter feed of the shop down the street. And nearly everything else. The future, the story says, is one in which we go direct. It's a story about efficiency and democracy. Eliminating the evil middleman sitting between us and what we want sounds good. In a way, disintermediation is taking on the idea of media itself. The word media, after all, comes from the Latin for middle layer. It sits between us and the world. The core bargain is that it will connect us to what's happening, but at the price of direct experience. Disintermediation suggests we can have both. There's some truth to the description, of course, but while enthrallment to the gatekeepers is a real problem, disintermediation is as much mythology as fact. Its effect is to make the new mediators, the new gatekeepers, invisible. It's about the many wresting power from the few, Time magazine announced when it made you the person of the year. But as law professor and Master Switch author Tim Wu says, the rise of networking did not eliminate intermediaries, but rather changed who they are. And while power moved toward consumers in the sense that we have exponentially more choice about what media we consume, the power still isn't held by consumers. Most people who are renting and leasing apartments don't go direct. They use the intermediary of Craigslist. Readers use Amazon.com. Searchers use Google. Friends use Facebook. And these platforms hold an immense amount of power, as much, in many ways, as the newspaper editors and record labels and other intermediaries that preceded them. But while we've raked the editors of New York Times and the producers of CNN over the coals for the stories they've missed and the interests they've served, we've given very little scrutiny to the interests behind the new curators. In July 2010, Google News rolled out a personalized version of its popular service. Sensitive to concerns about shared experience, Google made sure to highlight the top stories that are of broad, general interest. But look below that top band, and you will see only stories that are locally and personally relevant to you, based on the interests that you've demonstrated through Google and what articles you've clicked on in the past. Google's CEO doesn't beat around the bush when he describes where this is all headed. Most people will have personalized news reading experiences on mobile-type devices that will largely replace their traditional reading of newspapers, he tells an interviewer. And that kind of news consumption will be very personal, very targeted. It will remember what you know. It will suggest things that you might want to know. It will have advertising, right? And it will be as convenient and fun as reading a traditional newspaper or magazine. Since Krishna Bharat created the first prototype of Google News to monitor worldwide coverage after 9/11, Google News has become one of the top global portals for news. Tens of millions of visitors pull up the site each month, more than visit the BBC. Speaking at the IJ7 Innovation Journalism Conference at Stanford to a room full of fairly anxious newspaper professionals, Bharat laid out his vision. Journalists, Bharat explained, should worry about creating the content, and other people in technology should worry about bringing the content to the right group. Given the article, what's the best set of eyeballs for it? And that can be solved by personalization. In many ways, Google News is still a hybrid model, driven in part by the judgment of a professional editorial class. When a Finnish editor asked Bharat what determines the priority of stories, he emphasized that newspaper editors themselves still have disproportionate control. "We pay attention," he said, "to the editorial decisions that different editors have made, what your paper chose to cover, when you published it, and where you placed it on your front page." New York Times editor Bill Keller, in other words, still has a disproportionate ability to affect a story's prominence on Google News. It's a tricky balance. On the one hand, Bharat tells an interviewer, Google should promote what the reader enjoys reading. But at the same time, over-personalization that, for example, excludes important news from the picture would be a disaster. Bharat doesn't seem to have fully resolved the dilemma, even for himself. I think people care about what other people care about, what other people are interested in, most important, their social circle, he says. Bharat's vision is to move Google News off Google's site and onto the sites of other content producers. Once we get personalization working for news, Bharat tells the conference, we can take that technology and make it available to publishers so they can transform their website appropriately to suit the interests of each visitor. Krishna Bharat is in the hot seat for a good reason. While he's respectful to the front page editors who pepper him with questions and his algorithm depends on their expertise, Google News, if it's successful, may ultimately put a lot of front page editors out of work. Why visit your local paper's website, after all, if Google's personalized site has already pulled the best pieces? The Internet's impact on news was explosive in more ways than one. It expanded the news space by force, sweeping older enterprises out of its path. It dismantled the trust that news organizations had built. In its wake lies a more fragmented and shattered public space than the one that came before. It's no secret that trust in journalists and news providers has plummeted in recent years, but the shape of the curve is mysterious. According to a Pew poll, Americans lost more faith in news agencies between 2007 and 2010 than they did in the prior 12 years. Even the debacle over Iraq's WMDs didn't make much of a dent in the numbers, but whatever happened in 2007 did. While we still don't have conclusive proof, it appears that this, too, is an effect of the Internet. When you're getting news from one source, the source doesn't draw your attention much to its own errors and omissions. Corrections, after all, are buried in tiny type on an inside page. But as masses of news readers went online and began to hear from multiple sources, the differences in coverage were drawn out and amplified. You don't hear about the New York Times's problems much from the New York Times, but you do hear about them from political blogs like the Daily Kos or Little Green Footballs, and from groups on both sides of the spectrum like Move On or Right March. More voices, in other words, means less trust in any given voice. As Internet thinker Clay Shirky has pointed out, the new low trust levels may not be inappropriate. It may be that the broadcast era kept trust artificially high, but as a consequence, for most of us now, the difference in authority between a blog post and an article in The New Yorker is much smaller than one would think. Editors at Yahoo News, the biggest news site on the Internet, can see this trend in action. With over 85 million daily visitors, when Yahoo links to articles on other servers, even those of nationally known papers, it has to give technicians advance warning so that they can handle the load. A single link can generate up to 12 million views, but according to an executive in the news department, it doesn't matter much to Yahoo's users where the news is coming from. A spicy headline will win over a more trusted news source any day. People don't make much of a distinction between the New York Times and some random blogger, the executive told me. This is Internet news. Each article ascends the most forwarded lists or dies an ignominious death on its own. In the old days, Rolling Stone readers would get the magazine in the mail and leaf through it. Now, the popular stories circulate online, independent of the magazine. I read the exposé on General Stanley McChrystal, but had no idea that the cover story was about Lady Gaga. The attention economy is ripping the binding, and the pages that get read are the pages that are frequently the most topical, scandalous, and viral. Nor is debundling just about print media. While the journalistic hand-wringing has focused mostly on the fate of the newspaper, TV channels face the same dilemma. From Google to Microsoft to Comcast, executives are quite clear that what they call convergence is coming soon. Close to 1 million Americans are unplugging from cable TV offerings and getting their video online every year, and those numbers will accelerate as more services like Netflix's Movie on Demand and Hulu go online. When TV goes fully digital, channels become little more than brands, and the order of programs, like the order of articles, is determined by the user's interest and attention, not the station manager. And of course, that opens the door for personalization. Internet-connected TV is going to be a reality. It will dramatically change the ad industry forever. Ads will become interactive and delivered to individual TV sets according to the user, Google VP for Global Media Enrique De Castro has said. We may say goodbye, in other words, to the yearly ritual of the Super Bowl commercial, which won't create the same buzz when everyone is watching different ads. If trust in news agencies is falling, it is rising in the new realm of amateur and algorithmic curation. If the newspaper and magazine are being torn apart on one end, the pages are being recompiled on the other, a different way every time. Facebook is an increasingly vital source of news for this reason. Our friends and family are more likely to know what's important and relevant to us than some newspaper editor in Manhattan. Personalization proponents often point to social media like Facebook to dispute the notion that we'll end up in a narrow, over-filtered world. Friend your softball buddy on Facebook, the argument goes, and you'll have to listen to his political rants, even if you disagree. Since they have trust, it's true that the people we know can bring some focus to topics outside our immediate purview. But there are two problems with relying on a network of amateur curators. First, by definition, the average person's Facebook friends will be much more like that person than a general interest news source. This is especially true because our physical communities are becoming more homogeneous as well, and we generally know people who live near us. Because your softball buddy lives near you, he's likely to share many of your views. It's ever less likely that we'll come to be close with people very different from us, online or off, and thus it's less likely we'll come into contact with different points of view. Second, personalization filters will get better and better at overlaying themselves on individuals' recommendations. Like your friend Sam's posts on football, but not his erratic musings on CSI? A filter watching and learning which pieces of content you interact with can start to sift one from another and undermine even the limited leadership that a group of friends and pundits can offer. Google Reader, another product from Google that helps people manage streams of posts from blogs, now has a feature called Sort by Magic, which does precisely this. This leads to the final way in which the future of media is likely to be different than we expected. Since its early days, Internet evangelists have argued that it was an inherently active medium. We think basically you watch television to turn your brain off, and you work on your computer when you want to turn your brain on, Apple founder Steve Jobs told Macworld in 2004. Among techies, these two paradigms came to be known as push technology and pull technology. A web browser is an example of pull technology. You put in an address, and your computer pulls information from that server. Television and the mail, on the other hand, are push technologies. The information shows up on the tube or at your doorstep without any action on your end. Internet enthusiasts were excited about the shift from push to pull for reasons that are now pretty obvious. Rather than wash the masses in waves of watered-down, lowest common denominator content, pull media put users in control. The problem is that pull is actually a lot of work. It requires you to be constantly on your feet, curating your own media experience. That's way more energy than TV requires during the whopping 36 hours a week that Americans watch today. In TV network circles, there's a name for the passive way with which Americans make most of those viewing decisions, the theory of least objectionable programming. Researching TV viewers' behavior in the 1970s, pay-per-view innovator Paul Klein noticed that people quit channel surfing far more quickly than one might suspect. During most of those 36 hours a week, the theory suggests, we're not looking for a program in particular. We're just looking to be unobjectionably entertained. This is part of the reason TV advertising has been such a bonanza for the channel's owners. Because people watch TV passively, they're more likely to keep watching when ads come on. When it comes to persuasion, passive is powerful. While the broadcast TV era may be coming to a close, the era of least objectionable programming probably isn't, and personalization stands to make the experience even more, well, unobjectionable. One of YouTube's top corporate priorities is the development of a product called Lean Back, which strings together videos in a row to provide the benefits of push and pull. It's less like surfing the web and more like watching TV, a personalized experience that lets the user do less and less. Like the music service Pandora, Lean Back viewers can easily skip videos and give the viewer feedback for picking the next videos. Thumbs up for this one, thumbs down for these three. Lean Back would learn. Over time, the vision is for Lean Back to be like your own personal TV channel, stringing together content you're interested in while requiring less and less engagement from you. Steve Jobs's proclamation that computers are for turning your brain on may have been a bit too optimistic. In reality, as personalized filtering gets better and better, the amount of energy we'll have to devote to choosing what we'd like to see will continue to decrease. And while personalization is changing our experience of news, it's also changing the economics that determine what stories get produced.
This is the end of the CD. The audiobook continues on the next CD.
The Big Board. The offices of Gawker Media, the ascendant blog empire based in Soho, look little like the newsroom of the New York Times a few miles to the north. But the driving difference between the two is the flat-screen TV that hovers over the room. This is the big board, and on it are a list of articles and numbers. The numbers represent the number of times each article has been read, and they're big. Gawker's websites routinely see hundreds of millions of page views a month. The big board captures the top posts across the company's websites, which focus on everything from media, Gawker, to gadgets, Gizmodo, to porn, Fleshbot. Write an article that makes it onto the big board, and you're liable to get a raise. Stay off it for too long, and you may need to find a different job. At the New York Times, reporters and bloggers aren't allowed to see how many people click on their stories. This isn't just a rule, it's a philosophy that the Times lives by. The point of being the newspaper of record is to provide readers with the benefit of excellent, considered editorial judgment. We don't let metrics dictate our assignments and play, New York Times editor Bill Keller said, because we believe readers come to us for our judgment, not the judgment of the crowd. We're not American Idol. Readers can vote with their feet by subscribing to another paper if they like, but the Times doesn't pander. Younger Times writers who are concerned about such things have to essentially bribe the paper's system administrators to give them a peek at their stats. The paper does use aggregate statistics to determine which online features to expand or cut. If the Internet's current structures mostly tend toward fragmentation and local homogeneity, there is one exception. The only thing that's better than providing articles that are relevant to you is providing articles that are relevant to everyone. Traffic watching is a new addiction for bloggers and managers, and as more sites publish their most popular lists, readers can join in the fun too. Of course, journalistic traffic chasing isn't exactly a new phenomenon. Since the 1800s, papers have boosted their circulations with sensational reports. Joseph Pulitzer, in honor of whom the eponymous prizes are awarded each year, was a pioneer of using scandal, sex, fear-mongering, and innuendo to drive sales. But the Internet adds a new level of sophistication and granularity to the pursuit. Now the Huffington Post can put an article on its front page and know within minutes whether it's trending viral. If it is, the editors can kick it by promoting it more heavily. The dashboard that allows editors to watch how stories are doing is considered the crown jewel of the enterprise. Associated Content pays an army of online contributors small amounts to troll search queries and write pages that answer the most common questions. Those whose pages see a lot of traffic share in the advertising revenue. Sites like Dig and Reddit attempt to turn the whole Internet into a most popular list with increasing sophistication by allowing users to vote submitted articles from throughout the web onto the site's front page. Reddit's algorithm even has a kind of physics built into it so that articles that don't receive a constant amount of approval will begin to fade, and its front page mixes the articles the group thinks are most important with your personal preferences and behavior, a marriage of the filter bubble and the most popular list. Las Últimas Noticias, a major paper in Chile, began basing its content entirely on what readers clicked on in 2004. Stories with lots of clicks got follow-ups, and stories with no clicks got killed. The reporters don't have beats anymore. They just try to gin up stories that will get clicks. At Yahoo's popular Upshot News blog, a team of editors mine the data produced by streams of search queries to see what terms people are interested in real time. Then they produce articles responsive to those queries. When a lot of people search for Obama's birthday, Upshot produces an article in response, and soon the searchers are landing on a Yahoo page and seeing Yahoo advertising. We feel like the differentiator here, what separates us from a lot of our competitors, is our ability to aggregate all this data, the vice president of Yahoo Media told the New York Times. This idea of creating content in response to audience insight and audience needs is one component of the strategy, but it's a big component. And what tops the traffic charts? If it bleeds, it leads, is one of the few news maxims that has continued into the new era. Obviously, what's popular differs among audiences. A study of the Times' most popular list found that articles that touched on Judaism were often forwarded, presumably due to the Times' readership. In addition, the study concluded, more practically useful, surprising, effect-laden, and positively balanced articles are more likely to be among the newspaper's most emailed stories on a given day, as are articles that evoke more awe, anger, and anxiety, and less sadness. Elsewhere, the items that top most popular lists get a bit more crass. The site BuzzFeed recently linked to the headline that has everything, from Britain's Evening Herald, "Woman in sumo wrestler suit assaulted her ex-girlfriend in gay pub after she waved at a man dressed as a Snickers bar." The top story in 2005 for the Seattle Times stayed on the most read list for weeks. It concerned a man who died after having sex with a horse. The Los Angeles Times' top story in 2007 was an article about the world's ugliest dog. Responsiveness to the audience sounds like a good thing, and in a lot of cases, it is. If we view the role of cultural products as giving us something to talk about, writes a Wall Street Journal reporter who looked into the most popular phenomenon, then the most important thing might be that everyone sees the same thing and not what the thing is. Traffic chasing takes media making off its Olympian heights, placing journalists and editors on the same plane with everyone else. The Washington Post ombudsman described journalists' often paternalistic approach to readers. In a past era, there was little need to share marketing information with the Post's newsroom. Profits were high, circulation was robust, editors decided what they thought readers needed, not necessarily what they wanted. The Gawker model is almost the precise opposite. If the Washington Post emulates Dad, these new enterprises are more like fussy, anxious children squalling to be played with and picked up. When I asked him about the prospects for important but unpopular news, the Media Lab's Nicholas Negroponte smiled. On one end of the spectrum, he said, is sycophantic personalization. You're so great and wonderful, and I'm going to tell you exactly what you want to hear. On the other hand, is the parental approach. I'm going to tell you this, whether you want to hear this or not, because you need to know. Currently, we're headed in the sycophantic direction. There will be a long period of adjustment, says Professor Michael Schudson, as the separation of church and state is breaking down, so to speak. In moderation, that seems okay, but Gawker's big board is a scary extreme. It's surrender. Of Apple and Afghanistan. Google News pays more attention to political news than many of the creators of the filter bubble. After all, it draws in large part on the decisions of professional editors. But even in Google News, stories about Apple trump stories about the war in Afghanistan. I enjoy my iPhone and iPad, but it's hard to argue that these things are of similar importance to developments in Afghanistan. But this Apple-centric ranking is indicative of what the combination of popular lists and the filter bubble will leave out, things that are important but complicated. If traffic ends up guiding coverage, the Washington Post's ombudsman writes, will the Post choose not to pursue some important stories because they're dull? Will an article about, say, child poverty ever seem hugely personally relevant to many of us, beyond the academics studying the field and the people directly affected? Probably not, but it's still important to know about. Critics on the left frequently argue that the nation's top media underreport the war. But for many of us, myself including, reading about Afghanistan is a chore. The story is convoluted, confusing, complex, and depressing. In the editorial judgment of The Times, however, I need to know about it, and because they persist in putting it on the front page despite what must be abominably low traffic rates, I continue to read about it. This doesn't mean The Times is overruling my own inclinations. It's just supporting one of my inclinations, to be informed about the world, over the more immediate inclination to click on whatever tickles my fancy. There are places where media that prioritize importance over popularity or personal relevance are useful, even necessary. Clay Shirky points out that newspaper readers always mostly skipped over the political stuff, but to do so, they had to at least glance at the front page, and so, if there was a huge political scandal, enough people would know about it to make an impact at the polls. The question, Shirky says, is how can the average citizen ignore news of the day to the 99th percentile and periodically be alarmed when there is a crisis? How do you threaten business and civic leaders with the possibility that if things get too corrupt, the alarm can be sounded? The front page played that role, but now it's possible to skip it entirely. Which brings us back to John Dewey. In Dewey's vision, it is these issues, indirect, extensive, enduring, and serious consequences of conjoint and interacting behavior, that call the public into existence. The important matters that indirectly touch all of our lives but exist out of the sphere of our immediate self-interest are the bedrock and the raison d'etre of democracy. American Idol may unite a lot of us around the same fireplace, but it doesn't call out the citizen in us. For better or worse, I'd argue for better, the editors of the old media did. There's no going back, of course, nor should there be. The Internet still has the potential to be a better medium for democracy than broadcast, with its one-direction-only information flows, ever could be. As journalist A.J. Liebling pointed out, freedom of the press was for those who owned one. Now, we all do. But at the moment, we're trading a system with a defined and well-debated sense of its civic responsibilities and roles for one with no sense of ethics. The big board is tearing down the wall between editorial decision-making and the business side of the operation. While Google and others are beginning to grapple with the consequences, most personalized filters have no way of prioritizing what really matters but gets fewer clicks. And in the end, give the people what they want is a brittle and shallow civic philosophy. But the rise of the filter bubble doesn't just affect how we process news, it can also affect how we think. 3. The Adderall Society. It is hardly possible to overrate the value of placing human beings in contact with persons dissimilar to themselves and with modes of thought and action unlike those with which they are familiar. Such communication has always been, and is peculiarly in the present age, one of the primary sources of progress. John Stuart Mill. The manner in which some of the most important individual discoveries were arrived at reminds one more of a sleepwalker's performance than an electronic brain's. Arthur Kessler, The Sleepwalkers. In the spring of 1963, Geneva was swarming with diplomats. Delegations from 18 countries had arrived for negotiations on the Nuclear Test Ban Treaty, and meetings were underway in scores of locations throughout the Swiss capital. After one afternoon of discussions between the American and Russian delegations, a young KGB officer approached a 40-year-old American diplomat named David Mark. "I'm new on the Soviet delegation, and I'd like to talk to you," he whispered to Mark in Russian. "But I don't want to talk here. I want to have lunch with you." After reporting the contact to colleagues at the CIA, Mark agreed, and the two men planned a meeting at a local restaurant the following day. At the restaurant, the officer, whose name was Yuri Nosenko, explained that he'd gotten into a bit of a scrape. On his first night in Geneva, Nosenko had drunk too much and brought a prostitute back to his hotel room. When he awoke, to his horror, he found that his emergency stash of $900 in Swiss francs was missing. No small sum in 1963. "I've got to make it up," Nosenko told him. "I can give you some information that will be very interesting to the CIA, and all I want is my money." They set up a second meeting, to which Nosenko arrived in an obviously inebriated state. "I was snookered," Nosenko admitted later. "Very drunk." In exchange for the money, Nosenko promised to spy for the CIA in Moscow, and in January 1964, he met directly with CIA handlers to discuss his findings. This time, Nosenko had big news. He claimed to have handled the KGB file of Lee Harvey Oswald and said it contained nothing suggesting the Soviet Union had foreknowledge of Kennedy's assassination, potentially ruling out Soviet involvement in the event. He was willing to share more of the file's details with the CIA if he would be allowed to defect and resettle in the United States. Nosenko's offer was quickly transmitted to CIA headquarters in Langley, Virginia. It seemed like a potentially enormous break. Only months after Kennedy had been shot, determining who was behind his assassination was one of the agency's top priorities. But how could they know if Nosenko was telling the truth? James Jesus Angleton, one of the lead agents on Nosenko's case, was skeptical. Nosenko could be a trap, even part of a master plot to draw the CIA off the trail. After much discussion, the agents agreed to let Nosenko defect. If he was lying, it would indicate that the Soviet Union did know something about Oswald, and if he was telling the truth, he would be useful for counterintelligence. As it turned out, they were wrong about both. Nosenko traveled to the United States in 1964, and the CIA collected a massive, detailed dossier on their latest catch. But almost as soon as he started the debriefing process, inconsistencies began to emerge. Nosenko claimed he'd graduated from his officer training program in 1949, but the CIA's documents indicated otherwise. He claimed to have no access to documents that KGB officers of his station ought to have had. And why was this man with a wife and child at home in Russia defecting without them? Angleton became more and more suspicious, especially after his drinking buddy, Kim Philby, was revealed to be a Soviet spy. Clearly, Nosenko was a decoy sent to dispute and undermine the intelligence the agency was getting from another Soviet defector. The debriefings became more intense. In 1964, Nosenko was thrown into solitary confinement, where he was subjected for several years to harsh interrogation intended to break him and force him to confess. In 1 week, he was subjected to polygraph tests for 28.5 hours. Still, no break was forthcoming. Not everyone at the CIA thought Nosenko was a plant, and as more details from his biography became clear, it came to seem more and more likely that the man they had imprisoned was no spymaster. Nosenko's father was the Minister of Shipbuilding and a member of the Communist Party Central Committee, who had buildings named after him. When young, Yuri had been caught stealing at the Naval Preparatory School and was beaten up by his classmates. His mother had complained directly to Stalin. Some of his classmates were sent to the Russian front as punishment. It was looking more and more as though Yuri was just the spoiled brat son of a top leader and a bit of a mess. The reason for the discrepancy in graduation dates became clear. Nosenko had been held back a year in school for flunking his exam in Marxism-Leninism, and he was ashamed of it. By 1968, the balance of senior CIA agents came to believe that the agency was torturing an innocent man. They gave him $80,000 and set him up in a new identity somewhere in the American South. But the emotional debate over his veracity continued to haunt the CIA for decades, with master plan theorists sparring with those who believed he was telling the truth. In the end, 6 separate investigations were made into Nosenko's case. When he passed away in 2008, the news of his death was relayed to the New York Times by a senior intelligence official who refused to be identified. One of the officials most affected by the internal debate was an intelligence analyst by the name of Richards Hewer. Hewer had been recruited to the CIA during the Korean War, but he had always been interested in philosophy, and especially the branch known as epistemology, the study of knowledge. Although Hewer wasn't directly involved in the Nosenko case, he was required to be briefed on it for other work he was doing, and he'd initially fallen for the master plot hypothesis. Years later, Hewer set out to analyze the analysts, to figure out where the flaws were in the logic that had led to Nosenko's lost years in a CIA prison. The result is a slim volume called The Psychology of Intelligence Analysis, whose preface is full of laudatory comments by Hewer's colleagues and bosses. The book is a kind of psychology and epistemology 101 for would-be spooks. For Hewer, the core lesson of the Nosenko debacle was clear. Intelligence analysts should be self-conscious about their reasoning processes. They should think about how they make judgments and reach conclusions, not just about the judgments and conclusions themselves. Despite evidence to the contrary, Hewer wrote, we have a tendency to believe that the world is as it appears to be. Children eventually learn that a snack removed from view doesn't disappear from the universe, but even as we mature, we still tend to conflate seeing with believing. Philosophers call this view naive realism, and it is as seductive as it is dangerous. We tend to believe we have full command of the facts and that the patterns we see in them are facts as well. Angleton, the master theory proponent, was sure that Nosenko's pattern of factual errors indicated that he was hiding something and was breaking under pressure. So what's an intelligence analyst, or anyone who wants to get a good picture of the world for that matter, to do? First, Hewer suggests, we have to realize that our idea of what's real often comes to us second-hand and in a distorted form, edited, manipulated, and filtered through media, other human beings, and the many distorting elements of the human mind. Nosenko's case was riddled with these distorting factors, and the unreliability of the primary source was only the most obvious one. As voluminous as the set of data that the CIA had compiled on Nosenko was, it was incomplete in certain important ways. The agency knew a lot about his rank and status, but had learned very little about his personal background and internal life. This led to a basic, unquestioned assumption. The KGB would never let a screw-up serve at this high level. Therefore, he must be deceiving us. To achieve the clearest possible image of the world, Hewer writes, analysts need more than information. They also need to understand the lenses through which this information passes. Some of these distorting lenses are outside of our heads. Like a biased sample in an experiment, a lopsided selection of data can create the wrong impression. For a number of structural and historical reasons, the CIA record on Nosenko was woefully inadequate when it came to the man's personal history. And some of them are cognitive processes. We tend to convert lots of pages of data into likely to be true, for example. When several of them are at work at the same time, it becomes quite difficult to see what's actually going on. a funhouse mirror reflecting a funhouse mirror reflecting reality. This distorting effect is one of the challenges posed by personalized filters. Like a lens, the filter bubble invisibly transforms the world we experience by controlling what we see and don't see. It interferes with the interplay between our mental processes and our external environment. In some ways, it can act like a magnifying glass, helpfully expanding our view of a niche area of knowledge. But at the same time, personalized filters limit what we are exposed to, and therefore affect the way we think and learn. They can upset the delicate cognitive balance that helps us make good decisions and come up with new ideas. And because creativity is also a result of this interplay between mind and environment, they can get in the way of innovation. If we want to know what the world really looks like, we have to understand how filters shape and skew our view of it. A fine balance. It's become a bit in vogue to pick on the human brain. We're predictably irrational, in the words of behavioral economist Dan Ariely's best-selling book. Stumbling on Happiness author Dan Gilbert presents volumes of data to demonstrate that we're terrible at figuring out what makes us happy. Like audience members at a magic show, we're easily conned, manipulated, and misdirected. All of this is true, but as Being Wrong author Catherine Schultz points out, it's only one part of the story. Human beings may be a walking bundle of miscalculations, contradictions, and irrationalities, but we're built that way for a reason. The same cognitive processes that lead us down the road to error and tragedy are the root of our intelligence and our ability to cope with and survive in a changing world. We pay attention to our mental processes when they fail, but that distracts us from the fact that most of the time, our brains do amazingly well. The mechanism for this is a cognitive balancing act. Without our ever thinking about it, our brains tread a tightrope between learning too much from the past and incorporating too much new information from the present. The ability to walk this line, to adjust to the demands of different environments and modalities, is one of human cognition's most astonishing traits. Artificial intelligence has yet to come anywhere close. In two important ways, personalized filters can upset this cognitive balance between strengthening our existing ideas and acquiring new ones. First, the filter bubble surrounds us with ideas with which we're already familiar and already agree, making us overconfident in our mental frameworks. Second, it removes from our environment some of the key prompts that make us want to learn. To understand how, we have to look at what's being balanced in the first place, starting with how we acquire and store information. Filtering isn't a new phenomenon. It's been around for millions of years. Indeed, it was around before humans even existed. Even for animals with rudimentary senses, nearly all of the information coming in through their senses is meaningless, but a tiny sliver is important and sometimes life-preserving. One of the primary functions of the brain is to identify that sliver and decide what to do about it. In humans, one of the first steps is to massively compress the data. As Nassim Nicholas Taleb says, information wants to be reduced, and every second we reduce a lot of it, compressing most of what our eyes see and ears hear into concepts that capture the gist. Psychologists call these concepts schemata. One of them is a schema, and they're beginning to be able to identify particular neurons or sets of neurons that correlate with each one, firing, for example, when you recognize a particular object, like a chair. Schemata ensure that we aren't constantly seeing the world anew. Once we've identified something as a chair, we know how to use it. We don't do this only with objects. We do it with ideas as well. In a study of how people read the news, researcher Doris Graber found that stories were relatively quickly converted into schemata for the purposes of memorization. Details that do not seem essential at the time and much of the context of a story are routinely paired, she writes in her book, Processing the News. Such leveling and sharpening involves condensation of all features of a story. Viewers of a news segment on a child killed by a stray bullet might remember the child's appearance and tragic background, but not the reportage that overall crime rates are down. Schemata can actually get in the way of our ability to directly observe what's happening. In 1981, researcher Claudia Cohen instructed subjects to watch a video of a woman celebrating her birthday. Some are told that she's a waitress, while others are told she's a librarian. Later, the groups are asked to reconstruct the scene. The people who are told she's a waitress remember her having a beer. Those told she was a librarian remember her wearing glasses and listening to classical music. The video shows her doing all three. The information that didn't jibe with her profession was more often forgotten. In some cases, schemata are so powerful they can even lead to information being fabricated. Doris Graber, the news researcher, found that up to a third of her 48 subjects had added details to their memories of 12 television news stories shown to them, based on the schemata those stories activated. Once we've acquired schemata, we're predisposed to strengthen them. Psychological researchers call this confirmation bias, a tendency to believe things that reinforce our existing views, to see what we want to see. One of the first and best studies of confirmation bias comes from the end of the college football season in 1951, Princeton versus Dartmouth. Princeton hadn't lost a game all season. Its quarterback, Dick Kazmaier, had just been on the cover of Time. Things started off pretty rough, but after Kazmaier was sent off the field in the second quarter with a broken nose, the game got really dirty. In the ensuing melee, a Dartmouth player ended up with a broken leg. Princeton won, but afterward there were recriminations in both colleges' papers. Princetonians blamed Dartmouth for starting the low blows. Dartmouth thought Princeton had an axe to grind once their quarterback got hurt. Luckily, there were some psychologists on hand to make sense of the conflicting versions of events. They asked a group of students from both schools who hadn't seen the game to watch a film of it and count how many infractions each side made. Princeton students, on average, saw 9.8 infractions by Dartmouth. Dartmouth students thought their team was guilty of only 4.3. One Dartmouth alumnus, who received a copy of the film, complained that his version must be missing parts. He didn't see any of the roughhousing he'd heard about. Boosters of each school saw what they wanted to see, not what was actually on the film. Philip Tetlock, a political scientist, found similar results when he invited a variety of academics and pundits into his office and asked them to make predictions about the future in their areas of expertise. Would the Soviet Union fall in the next 10 years? In what year would the U.S. economy start growing again? For 10 years, Tetlock kept asking these questions. He asked them not only of experts, but also of folks he'd brought in off the street, plumbers and school teachers with no special expertise in politics or history. When he finally compiled the results, even he was surprised. It wasn't just that the normal folks' predictions beat the experts' predictions weren't even close. Why? Experts have a lot invested in the theories they've developed to explain the world, and after a few years of working on them, they tend to see them everywhere. For example, bullish stock analysts banking on rosy financial scenarios were unable to identify the housing bubble that nearly bankrupted the economy, even though the trends that drove it were pretty clear to anyone looking. It's not just that experts are vulnerable to confirmation bias, it's that they're especially vulnerable to it. No schema is an island. Ideas in our heads are connected in networks and hierarchies. Key isn't a useful concept without lock, door, and a slew of other supporting ideas. If we change these concepts too quickly, altering our concept of door without adjusting lock, for example, we could end up removing or altering ideas that other ideas depend on and have the whole system come crashing down. Confirmation bias is a conservative mental force helping to shore up our schemata against erosion. Learning, then, is a balance. Jean Piaget, one of the major figures in developmental psychology, describes it as a process of assimilation and accommodation. Assimilation happens when children adapt objects to their existing cognitive structures, as when an infant identifies every object placed in the crib as something to suck on. Accommodation happens when we adjust our schemata to new information. Ah, this isn't something to suck on, it's something to make a noise with. We modify our schemata to fit the world, and the world to fit our schemata. And it's in properly balancing the two processes that growth occurs and knowledge is built. The filter bubble tends to dramatically amplify confirmation bias. In a way, it's designed to. Consuming information that conforms to our ideas of the world is easy and pleasurable. Consuming information that challenges us to think in new ways or question our assumptions is frustrating and difficult. This is why partisans of one political stripe tend not to consume the media of another. As a result, an information environment built on click signals will favor content that supports our existing notions about the world over content that challenges them. During the 2008 presidential campaign, for example, rumors swirled persistently that Barack Obama, a practicing Christian, was a follower of Islam. Emails circulated to millions offering proof of Obama's real religion and reminding voters that Obama spent time in Indonesia and had the middle name Hussein. The Obama campaign fought back on television and encouraged its supporters to set the facts straight. But even a front-page scandal about his Christian priest, Reverend Jeremiah Wright, was unable to puncture the mythology. 15% of Americans stubbornly held on to the idea that Obama was a Muslim. That's not so surprising. Americans have never been very well informed about our politicians. What's perplexing is that since the election, the percentage of Americans who hold that belief has nearly doubled, and the increase, according to data collected by the Pew Charitable Trusts, has been greatest among people who are college-educated. People with some college education were more likely in some cases to believe the story than people with none. A strange state of affairs. Why? According to the New Republic's John Chait, the answer lies with the media. Partisans are more likely to consume news sources that confirm their ideological beliefs. People with more education are more likely to follow political news. Therefore, people with more education can actually become miseducated. And while this phenomenon has always been true, the filter bubble automates it. In the bubble, the proportion of content that validates what you know goes way up. Which brings us to the second way the filter bubble can get in the way of learning. It can block what researcher Travis Prue calls meaning threats, the confusing, unsettling occurrences that fuel our desire to understand and acquire new ideas. Researchers at the University of California at Santa Barbara asked subjects to read two modified versions of The Country Doctor, a strange, dreamlike short story by Franz Kafka. "A seriously ill man was waiting for me in a village 10 miles distant," begins the story. "A severe snowstorm filled the space between him and me. The doctor has no horse, but when he goes to the stable, it's warm, and there's a horsey scent. A belligerent groom hauls himself out of the muck and offers to help the doctor. The groom calls 2 horses and attempts to rape the doctor's maid, while the doctor is whisked to the patient's house in a snowy instant. And that's just the beginning. The weirdness escalates." The story concludes with a series of non sequiturs and a cryptic aphorism. "Once one responds to a false alarm on the night bell, there's no making it good again. Not ever." The Kafka-inspired version of the story includes meaning threats, incomprehensible events that threaten readers' expectations about the world and shake their confidence in their ability to understand. But the researchers also prepared another version of the story with a much more conventional narrative, complete with a happily ever after ending and appropriate cartoony illustrations. The mysteries and odd occurrences are explained. After reading one version or the other, the study's participants were asked to switch tasks and identify patterns in a set of numbers. The group that read the version adopted from Kafka did nearly twice as well, a dramatic increase in the ability to identify and acquire new patterns. The key to our study is that our participants were surprised by the series of unexpected events, and they had no way to make sense of them, Prue wrote. Hence, they strived to make sense of something else. For similar reasons, a filtered environment could have consequences for curiosity. According to psychologist George Loewenstein, curiosity is aroused when we're presented with an information gap. It's a sensation of deprivation. A presence wrapping deprives us of the knowledge of what's in it, and as a result, we become curious about its contents. But to feel curiosity, we have to be conscious that something's being hidden. Because the filter bubble hides things invisibly, we're not as compelled to learn about what we don't know. As University of Virginia Media Studies professor and Google expert Siva Vaidyanathan writes in The Googleization of Everything, learning is by definition an encounter with what you don't know, what you haven't thought of, what you couldn't conceive, and what you never understood or entertained as possible. It's an encounter with what's other, even with otherness as such. The kind of filter that Google interposes between an internet searcher and what a search yields shields the searcher from such radical encounters. Personalization is about building an environment that consists entirely of the adjacent unknown, the sports trivia or political punctuation marks that don't really shake our schemata but feel like new information. The personalized environment is very good at answering the questions we have, but not at suggesting questions or problems that are out of our sight altogether. It brings to mind the famous Pablo Picasso quotation, "Computers are useless. They can only give you answers." Stripped of the surprise of unexpected events and associations, a perfectly filtered world would provoke less learning. And there's another mental balance that personalization can upset: the balance between open-mindedness and focus that makes us creative. The Adderall Society. The drug Adderall is a mixture of amphetamines. Prescribed for attention deficit disorder, it's become a staple for thousands of overscheduled, sleep-deprived students, allowing them to focus for long stretches on a single arcane research paper or complex lab assignment. For people without ADD, Adderall also has a remarkable effect. On Arrowhead, an online forum for recreational drug users and mind hackers, there's post after post of testimonials to the drug's power to extend focus. "The part of my brain that makes me curious about whether I have new emails in my inbox apparently shut down," author Josh Foer wrote in an article on Slate. "Normally, I can only stare at my computer screen for about 20 minutes at a time. On Adderall, I was able to work in hour-long chunks." In a world of constant interruptions, as work demands only increase, Adderall is a compelling value proposition. Who couldn't use a little cognitive boost? Among the vocal class of neuroenhancement proponents, Adderall and drugs like it may even be the key to our economic future. If you're a 55-year-old in Boston, you have to compete with a 26-year-old from Mumbai now, and those kinds of pressures, to use enhancing drugs, are only going to grow, Zach Lynch of the neurotech consulting firm NeuroInsights told a New Yorker correspondent. But Adderall also has some serious side effects. It's addictive. It dramatically boosts blood pressure. And perhaps most important, it seems to decrease associative creativity. After trying Adderall for a week, Foer was impressed with its powers, cranking out pages and pages of text and reading through dense scholarly articles. But he wrote, "It was like I was thinking with blinders on." "With this drug," an Arrowhead experimenter wrote, "I became calculating and conservative. In the words of one friend, I think inside the box." Martha Farah, the director of the University of Pennsylvania's Center for Cognitive Neuroscience, has bigger worries. I'm a little concerned that we could be raising a generation of very focused accountants. Like many psychoactive drugs, we still know little about why Adderall has the effects it has, or even entirely what the effects are. But the drug works in part by increasing levels of the neurotransmitter norepinephrine, and norepinephrine has some very particular effects. For one thing, it reduces our sensitivity to new stimuli. ADHD patients call the problem hyperfocus, a trance-like, zoned-out ability to focus on one thing to the exclusion of everything else. On the internet, personalized filters could promote the same kind of intense, narrow focus you get from a drug like Adderall. If you like yoga, you get more information and news about yoga, and less about, say, bird watching or baseball. In fact, the search for perfect relevance and the kind of serendipity that promotes creativity push in opposite directions. If you like this, you'll like that, can be a useful tool, but it's not a source for creative ingenuity. By definition, ingenuity comes from the juxtaposition of ideas that are far apart, and relevance comes from finding ideas that are similar. Personalization, in other words, may be driving us toward an Adderall society in which hyperfocus displaces general knowledge and synthesis. Personalization can get in the way of creativity and innovation in three ways. First, the filter bubble artificially limits the size of our solution horizon, the mental space in which we search for solutions to problems. Second, the information environment inside the filter bubble will tend to lack some of the key traits that spur creativity. Creativity is a context-dependent trait. We're more likely to come up with new ideas in some environments than in others. The contexts that filtering creates aren't the ones best suited to creative thinking. Finally, the filter bubble encourages a more passive approach to acquiring information, which is at odds with the kind of exploration that leads to discovery. When your doorstep is crowded with salient content, there's little reason to travel any farther. In his seminal book, The Act of Creation, Arthur Koestler describes creativity as bisociation, the intersection of two matrices of thought. Discovery is an analogy no one has ever seen before. Friedrich Kekulé's epiphany about the structure of a benzene molecule after a daydream about a snake eating its tail is an example. So is Larry Page's insight to apply the technique of academic citation to search. Discovery often means simply the uncovering of something which has always been there but was hidden from the eye by the blinkers of habit, Koestler wrote. Creativity uncovers, selects, reshuffles, combines, synthesizes already existing facts, ideas, faculties, and skills. While we still have little insight into exactly where different words, ideas, and associations are located physically in the brain, researchers are beginning to be able to map the terrain abstractly. They know that when you feel as though a word is on the tip of your tongue, it usually is. And they can tell that some concepts are much further apart than others, in neural connections if not in actual physical brain space. Researcher Hans Eysenck has found evidence that the individual differences in how people do this mapping, how they connect concepts together, are the key to creative thought. In Eysenck's model, creativity is a search for the right set of ideas to combine. At the center of the mental search space are the concepts most directly related to the problem at hand, and as you move outward, you reach ideas that are more tangentially connected. The solution horizon delimits where we stop searching. When we're instructed to think outside the box represents the solution horizon, the limit of the conceptual area that we're operating in. Of course, solution horizons that are too wide are a problem too, because more ideas means exponentially more combinations. Programmers building artificially intelligent chess masters learned the importance of the solution horizon the hard way, The early ones trained the computer to look at every possible combination of moves. This resulted in an explosion of possibilities, which in turn meant that even very powerful computers could only look a limited number of moves ahead. Only when programmers discovered heuristics that allowed the computers to discard some of the moves did they become powerful enough to win against the grand masters of chess. Narrowing the solution horizon, in other words, was key. In a way, the filter bubble is a prosthetic solution horizon. It provides you with an information environment that's highly relevant to whatever problem you're working on. Often, this will be highly useful. When you search for restaurant, it's likely that you're also interested in near synonyms like bistro or cafe. But when the problem you're solving requires the bisociation of ideas that are indirectly related, as when Page applied the logic of academic citation to the problem of web search, the filter bubble may narrow your vision too much. What's more, some of the most important creative breakthroughs are spurred by the introduction of the entirely random ideas that filters are designed to rule out. The word serendipity originates with the fairy tale The Three Princes of Serendip, who are continually setting out in search of one thing and finding another. In what researchers call the evolutionary view of innovation, this element of random chance isn't just fortuitous, it's necessary. Innovation requires serendipity. Since the 1960s, a group of researchers, including Donald Campbell and Dean Simonton, has been pursuing the idea that at a cultural level, the process of developing new ideas looks a lot like the process of developing new species. The evolutionary process can be summed up in four words: blind variation, selective retention. Blind variation is the process by which mutations and accidents change genetic code, and it's blind because it's chaotic. It's variation that doesn't know where it's going. There's no intent behind it, nowhere in particular that it's headed. It's just the random recombination of genes. Selective retention is the process by which some of the results of blind variation, the offspring, are retained while others perish. When problems become acute enough for enough people, the argument goes, the random recombination of ideas in millions of heads will tend to produce a solution. In fact, it'll tend to produce the same solution in multiple different heads around the same time. The way we selectively combine ideas isn't always blind. As iSync's solution horizon suggests, we don't try to solve our problems by combining every single idea with every other idea in our heads. But when it comes to really new ideas, innovation is in fact often blind. Aaron Kantorovic and Yuval Naaman are two historians of science whose work focuses on paradigm shifts, like the move from Newtonian to Einsteinian physics. They argue that normal science, the day-to-day process of experimentation and prediction, doesn't benefit much from blind variation because scientists tend to discard random combinations and strange data. But in moments of major change, when our whole way of looking at the world shifts and recalibrates, serendipity is often at work. Blind discovery is a necessary condition for scientific revolution, they write, for a simple reason. The Einsteins and Copernicuses and Pasteurs of the world often have no idea what they're looking for. The biggest breakthroughs are sometimes the ones that we least expect. The filter bubble still offers the opportunity for some serendipity, of course. If you're interested in football and local politics, you might still see a story about a play that gives you an idea about how to win the mayoral campaign. But overall, there will tend to be fewer random ideas around. That's part of the point. For a quantified system like a personal filter, it's nearly impossible to sort the usefully serendipitous and randomly provocative from the just plain irrelevant. The second way in which the filter bubble can dampen creativity is by removing some of the diversity that prompts us to think in new and innovative ways. In one of the standard creativity tests developed by Carl Duncker in 1945, a researcher hands a subject a box of thumbtacks, a candle, and a book of matches. The subject's job is to attach the candle to the wall so that, when lit, it doesn't drip on the table below or set the wall on fire. Typically, people try to tack the candle to the wall or glue it by melting it or by building complex structures out of the wall with wax and tacks. But the solution, spoiler alert, is quite simple. Tack the inside of the box to the wall, then place the candle in the box. Duncker's test gets at one of the key impediments to creativity, what early creativity researcher George Catona described as the reluctance to break perceptual set. When you're handed a box full of tacks, you'll tend to register the box itself as a container. It takes a conceptual leap to see it as a platform, but even a small change in the test makes that much more likely. If subjects receive the box separately from the tacks, they tend to see the solution much more quickly. The process of mapping thing with tacks in it to the schema container is called coding. Creative candle platform builders are those who are able to code objects and ideas in multiple ways. Coding, of course, is very useful. It tells you what you can do with the object. Once you've decided that something fits in the chair schema, you don't have to think twice about sitting on it. But when the coding is too narrow, it impedes creativity. In study after study, creative people tend to see things in many different ways and put them in what researcher Arthur Cropley calls wide categories. The notes from a 1974 study in which participants were told to make groups of similar objects offers an amusing example of the trait in excess. Subject 30, a writer, sorted a total of 40 objects. In response to the candy cigar, he sorted the pipe, matches, cigar, apple, and sugar cubes, explaining that all were related to consumption. In response to the apple, he sorted only the wood block with the nail driven into it, explaining that the apple represented health and vitality, or yin, and that the wood block represented a coffin with a nail in it, or death, or yang. Other sortings were similar. It's not just artists and writers who use wide categories. As Cropley points out in Creativity in Education and Learning, the physicist Niels Bohr famously demonstrated this type of creative dexterity when he was given a university exam at the University of Copenhagen in 1905. One of the questions asked students to explain how they would use a barometer, an instrument that measures atmospheric pressure, to measure the height of a building. Bohr clearly knew what the instructor was going for. Students were supposed to check the atmospheric pressure at the top and bottom of the building and do some math. Instead, he suggested a more original method. One could tie a string to the barometer, lower it, and measure the string, thinking of the instrument as a thing with weight. The unamused instructor gave him a failing grade. His answer, after all, didn't show much understanding of physics. Bohr appealed, this time offering four solutions. You could throw the barometer off the building and count the seconds until it hit the ground, barometer as mass. You could measure the length of the barometer and of its shadow, then measure the building shadow and calculate its height, barometer as object with length. You could tie the barometer to a string and swing it at ground level and from the top of the building to determine the difference in gravity, barometer as mass again. Or you could use it to calculate air pressure. Bohr finally passed, and one moral of the story is pretty clear. Avoid smart-ass physicists. But the episode also explains why Bohr was such a brilliant innovator. His ability to see objects and concepts in many different ways made it easier for him to use them to solve problems. The kind of categorical openness that supports creativity also correlates with certain kinds of luck. While science has yet to find that there are people whom the universe favors, ask people to guess a random number, and we're all about equally bad at it. There are some traits that people who consider themselves to be lucky share. They're more open to new experiences and new people. They're also more distractible. Richard Wiseman, a luck researcher at the University of Hertfordshire in England, asked groups of people who considered themselves to be lucky and unlucky to flip through a doctored newspaper and count the number of photographs in it. On the second page, a big headline said, "Stop counting, there are 43 pictures." Another page offered £150 to readers who noticed it. Wiseman described the results. For the most part, the unlucky would just flip past these things. Lucky people would flip through and laugh and say, "There are 43 photos. That's what it says. Do you want me to bother counting?" We'd say, "Yeah, carry on." They'd flip some more and say, "Do I get my £150? Most of the unlucky people didn't notice. As it turns out, being around people and ideas unlike oneself is one of the best ways to cultivate this sense of open-mindedness and wide categories. Psychologists Charlene Nemeth and Julianne Kwan discovered that bilinguists are more creative than monolinguists, perhaps because they have to get used to the proposition that things can be viewed in several different ways. Even 45 minutes of exposure to a different culture can boost creativity. When a group of American students was shown a slideshow about China as opposed to one about the United States, their scores on several creativity tests went up. In companies, the people who interface with multiple different units tend to be greater sources of innovation than people who interface only with their own. While nobody knows for certain what causes this effect, it's likely that foreign ideas help us break open our categories. But the filter bubble isn't tuned for a diversity of ideas or of people. It's not designed to introduce us to new cultures. As a result, living inside it, we may miss some of the mental flexibility and openness that contact with difference creates. But perhaps the biggest problem is that the personalized web encourages us to spend less time in discovery mode in the first place. The Age of Discovery. In Where Good Ideas Come From, science author Stephen Johnson offers a natural history of innovation, in which he inventories and elegantly illustrates how creativity arises. Creative environments often rely on liquid networks, where different ideas can collide in different configurations. They arrive through serendipity. We set out looking for the answer to one problem and find another, and as a result, ideas emerge frequently in places where random collision is more likely to occur. Innovative environments, he writes, are better at helping their inhabitants explore the adjacent possible, the bisociated area in which existing ideas combine to produce new ones, because they expose a wide and diverse sample of spare parts, mechanical or conceptual, and they encourage novel ways of recombining those parts. His book is filled with examples of these environments, from primordial soup to coral reefs and high-tech offices, but Johnson continually returns to two, the city and the web. For complicated historical reasons, he writes, they are both environments that are powerfully suited for the creation, diffusion, and adoption of good ideas. There's no question that Johnson was right. The old, unpersonalized web offered an environment of unparalleled richness and diversity. Visit the Serendipity article in Wikipedia, he writes, and you are one click away from entries on LSD, Teflon, Parkinson's disease, Sri Lanka, Isaac Newton, and about 200 other topics of comparable diversity. But the filter bubble has dramatically changed the informational physics that determines which ideas we come in contact with, and the new, personalized web may no longer be as well suited for creative discovery as it once was. In the early days of the World Wide Web, when Yahoo was its king, the online terrain felt like an unmapped continent, and its users considered themselves discoverers and explorers. Yahoo was the village tavern where sailors would gather to swap tales about what strange beasts and distant lands they found out at sea. The shift from exploration and discovery to the intent-based search of today was inconceivable, an early Yahoo editor told search journalist John Battelle. Now, we go online expecting everything we want to find will be there. That's a major shift. This shift from a discovery-oriented web to a search and retrieval-focused web mirrors one other piece of the research surrounding creativity. Creativity experts mostly agree that it's a process with at least two key parts. Producing novelty requires a lot of divergent, generative thinking, the reshuffling and recombining that Kessler describes. Then there's a winnowing process, convergent thinking, as we survey the options for one that'll fit the situation. The serendipitous web attributes that Johnson praises, the way one can hop from article to article on Wikipedia, are friendly to the divergent part of that process. But the rise of the filter bubble means that increasingly the convergent, synthetic part of the process is built in. Battelle calls Google a database of intentions, each query representing something that someone wants to do or know or buy. Google's core mission, in many ways, is to transform those intentions into actions. But the better it gets at that, the worse it'll be at providing serendipity, which, after all, is the process of stumbling across the unintended. Google is great at helping us find what we know we want, but not at finding what we don't know we want. To some degree, the sheer volume of information available mitigates this effect. There's far more online content to choose from than there was in even the largest libraries. For an enterprising informational explorer, there's endless terrain to cover. But one of the prices of personalization is that we become a bit more passive in the process. The better it works, the less exploring we have to do. David Galerenter, a Yale professor and early supercomputing visionary, believes that computers will only serve us well when they can incorporate dream logic. One of the hardest, most fascinating problems of this cyber century is how to add drift to the net, he writes, so that your view sometimes wanders, as your mind wanders when you're tired, into places you hadn't planned to go. Touching the machine brings the original topic back. We need help overcoming rationality sometimes and allowing our thoughts to wander and metamorphose as they do in sleep. To be truly helpful, algorithms may need to work more like the fuzzy-minded, non-linear humans they're supposed to serve.
This is the end of the CD. The audiobook continues on the next CD.